Welcome back to the Cavaliers Do Cinema 2013 Year in View Roundup. Still haven't decided on the official title at of time of recording.
Yeah.
But in this episode, we're going to be counting down 5 to 1. 1 in 5!
That's our top five
films. Top five films of the year, as well as giving out our Best Actor Award, as well as our Meaner Awards.
Like biggest disappointment and most overrated.
Yes, we'll then be looking forward to 2014 and what we look forward to, as well as talking briefly about the award ceremony we pretend not to care about, even though it really defines our film-going experience.
It grinds our gears.
It
determines what gets made and whose films get
yes,
made
it does.
Again and
it
again.
Matters.
It really matters.
For better or worse. Yeah. And also, if you would like a prize, metaphorically, guess as to why we chose Arcade Fire's Afterlife for the 2013 podcast. You may know by the end of the podcast. But first,
I know. Is that supposed to be a surprise? I suppose not, seeing as I'm involved.
Well, you know.
Yeah,
but for the listeners at home. Anyway, let's get kicking.
So let's go with Best Support.
Best Support. We'll do a 1-2 punch. Best Support followed by
Best Performance. And we're not gonna divide it by gender.
No, which unfortunately means that basically this is an extremely phallocentric award.
But you know,
that's the nature of the films, and we feel like it's kind of more.
Yeah.
It's condescending to delineate. There's no. It's not. It's not a gender based skill acting. So we feel like it's inorganic to separate it by gender. But that does mean that these awards have more men.
There are a lot of dudes.
Yeah.
Just at it. So, yeah. So on Best Supporting Performance, we've essentially got some nominees. And then we'll name our favourite from that.
Okay, so, well, the nominees have to be James Franco in Spring Breakers.
Just, you know.
For obvious reasons.
Jonah Hill.
Two-time Academy Award nominee.
Jonah Hill. Beautiful.
For The Wolf of Wall Street.
Hilarious.
Lupita Nyong'o for 12 Years a Slave.
Michael Fassbender
for 12 Years a Slave.
Miles Page playing Papa George in Computer Chess.
No, that's not that pick.
That's not quite it.
Yes. So,
but you know, essentially
interesting how they group, because of course there are 2 12 Years a Slave nominations.
Yeah.
And then there are 2 roles that are these ridiculously grotesque, distinctly, uniquely American.
Blood-sucking.
Yeah, in James Franco and
two dudes screaming, look at my shit.
Basically. I got Scarface on repeat. So, anyway, would you like to read out the winner? Here's the envelope.
And the winner of the Cavaliers Year in Review Best Supporting Actor is...
The Cavies, as they call them.
The Cavies. I'm happy with that. The Cavies. The winner of the Cavie for Best Support is Jonah Hill. Fucking A.
Yeah, Jonah Hill.
Jonah.
He was so good in this role.
This needs a little bit. Because, I mean, obviously we're going to... Like, we will get to Wolf.
Will we? Maybe.
Surely we're going to have it in the runtime.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but basically Jonah Hill in this, like, he took... The actor's minimum, like, he took $60,000 for 7 months' work. Like, that's, like, you know, essentially just, like, the lowest possible, like, is the actor's minimum just, like, shit, I don't care, man. I want to say yes to this right now before they fucking change their minds. Yes, let's do it. So much respect for that. He's doing it for the love. He gives so much to this role.
He's so much energy.
So perfect for this role. And you can see that he has so much fun improvising, like, all this stuff. Like, if I had a retarded kid, I'd just, like, drive way out and just open the door and say, just go free.
And of course, you know, it's often like... DiCaprio is giving this very selfless performance as Jordan Belfort playing this kind of grotesque ode to American greed. But, you know... Whereas he has to be somewhat alluring as the de facto protagonist, Jonah Hill just runs away with being absolutely disgusting. It's so strong. But, I mean,
Having said that, there are moments of like genuine
catharsis. Yeah, there are. And like, he loves Belfort. And that's the thing.
And you see that real connection.
You see that connection, which I think, and what's really interesting, I don't think it's reciprocated. I think Belfort, you know, just sees him as another shit piece of shit he owns. Whereas, you know, for whatever...
Well, to a degree he does, obviously, because he...
Yeah, that's true. He does. He does risk himself to
some degree without giving anything. I mean, Wolf has kind of been out for a while. But, yeah, you know, we'll try to avoid
that you've seen Wolf because it's probably one of the more mainstream films that we're kind of tackling. But Jonah Hill's so good in this. What more is there to say?
I mean, what we need to say, we'll get to when we talk about Wolf. But he very narrowly beat out Franco in Spring Breakers.
And also, I think I was the both 12 years actors.
They were phenomenal. I mean, it's a phenomenal group to be in, including Miles Page. It's a phenomenal group of supporting actors here.
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about best performance.
So, best performance, essentially, we have another set of nominees. So, we got Adele Exarchopoulos for Blue is the Warmest Colour.
Yes, the performance so good that she actually got the Palme d'Or as well as the director, along with Léa Seydoux, which I feel like is disingenuous because it suggests that that film is about the love story. It's not. It's called The Life of Adele, Part 1 and 2 for obvious reasons, if you
we've just had a very, you know, an interesting chat about, you know, like the Cannes Film Festival and what that means, and the fact that like a lot of the jurors are American, including Steven Spielberg. So it's not as if it's like completely separate from the Oscars and separate from all that. But that's another thing that we can get to later. But so we haven't included Léa Seydoux in either Best Support or Best Performance.
She's good, but
she's great.
It's
but
not her like, film. I've seen better performances. The other nomination, obviously, if we nominated Jonah Hill, we have to nominate
Leo DiCaprio
in his best, the career best.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you've seen so many performances that Leo, like, has, like, you know...
He's good, but he's Leo.
He's good in, but he's so distinctly Leo. Like, he's got this tendency to really push and like, go really large with the character and really, like, hit everything and kind of play characters that just
with that
shout and just go really intense. And a lot of the time for me, it rings quite false, but the nature of this character demands that. And I don't think there's anybody who could have played that character as well as Leo. So boom on that one. We've also got Matt McConaughey. I'm chucking him in, having seen him in Dallas Buyers. Like it is justified. Like he is very, very good. And I will not be, as upset as I normally am when Best Actor is announced. Because he will win. It's a very Oscar. It's a very Oscar kind of.
I'd like to nominate Joaquin Phoenix for her.
I would like to support you in that.
Best supporting nomination there.
There we go.
Just such a full-bodied performance. Strangely enough, actually, you could compare his performance to Adele's in Blue is the Warmest Colour.
Can you? Really? I suppose you should elaborate.
Well, I just think that, you know, it's both the love story where you're just basically have to occupy the headspace. And I mean that in a very literal sense. The camera's just focusing on the head for the entire film. And he gives Theodore such depth and a lot of warmth.
Yeah.
And it's hard to build a performance on being very nice. And he does that, particularly in the year when we're nominating Fassbinder and Leonardo DiCaprio and Franco and Jonah Hill playing disgusting men. And to add to that list, another contender is James McAvoy.
James McAvoy in film. Like, that is, like, I think he's probably the worst out of them, of all of them. I think he's the most intensely, like, oh, God.
I think he, or, no.
No, for me, it's...
I think Belfort, DiCaprio is Belfort. He's so self-aware that puts his crimes to a level above everyone else.
Yeah.
And I think it's also,
Yeah, McAvoy in filth, like, we have just talked about in the last podcast, but he is just so fucking good in this. And, like, I mean, you kind of see him, like, talk about how much he knew he would be gutted if he didn't do this film. And, like, you see it, you see how much, like, energy and everything, and see that he's been drinking a bottle of whiskey a night throughout the shooting of that. Like, you see
the
oh, It's just it's a
well. All right, we don't agree on best act. On we don't best performance. So you give your pick first.
I'll go with Adele. Adele Exarchopoulos
for Blue is the Warmest Color, which is interesting because this was a film that
fucking hurricane.
I liked more than you.
Yeah,
but you went with performance, and I loved. You know, it's definitely a short list, but I think a big part of that film is also everything, the way it's shot and the choices made, as unethical as potentially the whole process was. So, loved it. I can't really separate her from the film the same way you can. Ironically, my choice for Best Actor is your Blue is the Warmest Colour, a film that, on the whole, I maybe didn't like as much, but I'm going with James McAvoy.
That's really funny.
Yes, we basically did the flip side. I thought McAvoy was just amazing. He never hit a false note. He never went too far, but he never, you know, he was committed the entire time. When he needs to be slightly sympathetic, he does so without dropping the harder edges of the character. And as I said, I don't think, and I guess maybe that's why I didn't put it in the same list, I don't think the direction was up to the, you know, the level that McAvoy's performance was, but fuck, it was a good performance.
Yeah, I mean, it only just did, and I mean, yeah, Franco was McAvoy was my second.
But I think it's good that we're both kind of recognizing films that otherwise we had problems with.
Yeah, I think it can almost subtract from a film having a performance too good, to be perfectly honest. If the performance,
I think that's my issue with Filth, in a sense, it's
that thing where people it's kind of always bugged me. People always kind of talk about if a director makes you notice what they're doing, then they're a bad director, and that kind of seems to be a really kind of popular mindset. I'm like, the entire consensus around actors is that if you notice how good they are, then that makes them much, much better. I'm just like, that is a complete double standard. It doesn't make any sense.
But that's a very Hollywood thing. It's not whereas...
Regardless, like in kind of popular kind of cinema going culture, like that's a more common viewpoint.
No, but it's not the French. Are like, I want to see the director's hand.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. But like, you know...
The French speak in German accents.
From our point of view and like the cinema culture that we kind of grown up in.
Yeah.
Is that kind of, you know, it's something that I've learned to kind of be very suspicious of.
Yeah, totally.
So, you know... but it's, I mean, having said that, like a really, really, really good performance when the director's hand isn't up to it, it does really ring. You kind of pick that false note.
I guess I just thought that, the director's hand was more visible in Blue than you did and vice versa.
And vice versa. Well, I suppose go.
Well, it's an interesting result.
That's interesting that we thought the performance was better because the film suffered that it was so good.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, maybe we both need to see each film again. I mean, I reckon I'll see Blue again
one day.
That's
interesting. That's quite revealing. Yes. Really? That's there you go.
Anyway, let's get to number 4 pick.
Wait, hang on.
What do you mean?
What happened to number five?
Did my player scoot? No, we had a tie.
Which I wasn't, you know, necessarily very happy about, because my essentially we both had one that was very high ranking for us but not as highly ranking for the other. So what was my number 2 was Sarah's number 8, and what was my number 7 was Sarah's number 3, I think,
which adds up as a very obvious tie in my opinion.
Yeah, so essentially should we say both of them or go with one and review it and then go with the other one? I think we should say both. Let's just say both.
No. Let's start with the one that you like more. Spring Breakers.
Okay. Oh, bugger you. I wanted to do her first. Okay.
This is my fucking dream, y'all. All this shit. Look at my shit. I got shorts every fucking color. I got designer t-shirts. I got gold bullets, motherfucking vampires. I got Scarface on repeat.
Best movie.
Scarface on repeat. Constant, y'all. I got Escape. Calvin Klein Escape. Mix that shit up with Calvin Klein B. Smell nice. I smell nice. Ain't a fucking bed. That's a fucking art piece. My fucking spaceship. USS Enterprise on this shit. I go to different planets on this motherfucker. Me and my fucking Franklin's here. We take off. Fucking take off. Look at my shit. Look at my shit. I got my blue Kool-Aid.
Ooh, you got your Kool-Aid.
I got my fucking nunchucks. I got shurikens. I got different flavors. I got them size. Look at that shit. I got size. I got blades. Look at my shit. This ain't nothing. I got rooms of this shit. I got my dark tanning oil. Lay out by the pool. Yeah. Put on my dark tanning oil. Machine guns. Look at this motherfucker.
Okay, so I love Spring Breakers. It was my number two. And basically, it's kind of difficult to know where to start with Spring Breakers.
Or generally talk about it. It's a film quite resistant to criticism.
Not so much that. It's just a film quite resistant to... Well, just... Okay. Basically,
well, all right, let's agree on something. It's not satire.
Wait, what?
It's not quite it's not, satire.
It's different. Like, yeah, no, okay,
to say
yeah,
it's
yeah,
satire is too reductive.
Yeah.
I think people who say it's satire are missing...
Don't necessarily understand Corinne's eyes.
Exactly.
And see, this is the
it's
thing, like...
too in having, love with yeah, its aesthetic.
Well, no, see, this is the thing, is that a lot of people have either looked at this to find... either condemnation or celebration.
Yeah.
And that's not Corinne. Corinne is a fucking trip. Like, that's the point, is that shit happens and images fly from everywhere and all this stuff happens and it's really grounded in a time and in an aesthetic quality, which is both, you know, it's aware of, like, the qualities that different people attribute to it and the qualities that it possesses, both
it is,
in
and
a negative and a positive way, but
it
doesn't think of them in those terms. It kind of just... is this realization and this execution of almost this cultural moment. It's almost like a really zeitgeist capturing, defining, not only in the content and in the kinds of people it's showing, but in the visual style of it.
But it just is a visual style. It's really, really pure cinema in that sense. I think
it's pure screen content.
Exactly.
Like, which is what's so cool about it is that it takes this, like, really elite kind of cinematic, like, knowledge and experience that Corinne has and kind of takes it into this realm which is more about screen and, you know, what rhythm does, what, like, the dizzying images, these vivid, striking impressions do. Like, it's just... And it just eliminates one of the banes for me of cinema. It's fucking story and just this plot, this attitude to plot. It's just, like, has this attitude to the three-act structure... which is so healthy, which is just fucking kill it. Like,
but,
I love that.
But it kills, I think, like...
the way it's structured, it's more like an album than a traditional... Like,
yeah,
you know,
it is.
You've got, like, these tracks. Like, it's not dialogue in scenes in a traditional sense. They're almost just these dialogue tracks that just loop back on each other, like, with verse-chorus structure. And, you know, like, they're like...
like having Scarface on repeat.
Oh, there you go. But they're,
I got Scarface on repeat.
Punctuated by the gun clicking, and, you know, it just kind of... The way it just kind of, like, moves from one moment to the next, like, you're never really lingering on anything. The only moment you're really lingering on anything is when you're in the pink Florida sun, a cornrowed gangster rapper... bent over a poolside white piano with girls surrounding him wearing DTF track pants. Like, that is the only moment that, like, you stop for half a second. And even then, you know that it's going to continue going relentlessly. And it is so ridiculous, that moment. It's so absurd. But, like, that's just what Corinne's all about. He's about those images.
I know. And I also think that the non-stop, unrelenting body parts flying, you know, the... the jiggling asses. It's just such a brilliant kind of Rorschach test of, is this attractive or disgusting? And
exactly.
I think it takes someone of Corinne's sort of perverse sensitivity to not tip it one way or the other, not to sexualize it or to make it deliberately disgusting. It's an object that the audience has to make of it.
The sexuality is oddly asexual.
Yes, it really is. But it can still be sexual. He doesn't make that decision for you. He doesn't.
And he
doesn't want to make a point with Spring Breakers. Mm. He wants you to experience it. And I think this is the difference. You know, Corinne, he chucks out story, he chucks out theme, he chucks out analysis. He's all aesthetics, but as opposed to Refn, who likes movies, or Lerman, you know, those, the contrast and the what he's putting in the frames is so fascinating. Mm. And just within, you know, it is like he's a true artist in the visual sense, in that, you know, all he needs is the imagery to create an incredibly interesting film.
See, I would disagree with the idea that there's no theme. I think you can find attributes and stuff and kind of like ascribe meaning and theme to it quite easily. But that's just a part of the process of being a Corinne audience member. And I mean, he's completely open to that, to the point where it kind of seems like it doesn't quite seem right to me to say that there's no theme, because that's just a part of it for him. He's like, he knows people are going to see it and take what they want from it.
But the
thing for me also is that the nature of his gaze as a filmmaker is kind of just see something that intrigues him and just zero in on it so completely that, you know, you can't help but have a thematic kind of cohesion come out in the film. And that's the thing.
Oh, yeah, totally. But it's all through the frame. It's not through the dialogue or
anybody who thinks that you need cohesive thematic content in the dialogue.
No, but it's not even through necessarily the... You can't analyze this film the same way that you'd analyze a lot of, you know, very good films that don't rely on dialogue. That's the way you'd say analyze Haneke.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing about this is that that is the point of it in a lot of ways, that it doesn't exist on this kind of uniform, diegetic time and space. A lot of the images that you see kind of feel like they've almost come from imagination or come from nowhere.
Yeah.
And like, that's the thing, is that there's nothing to say that that's any more real than any other of the moments that you see in the film. Is that it's just about the emotional, it's about this pure emotional and visceral, well, not even just, it's just this sensory engagement. But the thing is that, you know, critical engagement as much as emotional and visual engagement is, they're all completely valid on, you know, on the same level. And what I find so fascinating about it is that it completely... The thing is, it's not like that's unjustified thematically. Like, the characters in this are constantly saying... I mean, for all theme not being communicated in dialogue, they're like, pretend like it's a video game, pretend like it's a movie, it's all a dream, it's all a dream. You know, like that. The great beauty for me of Spring Breakers in a way... Is that balance of the reality and unreality of modern hyper-reality.
Yeah, and I agree. And it's really important, though, not to take that line as a cue that he's doing, as I said, a satire on media. Yeah. Every kind of obvious reading you find of Spring Breakers, reject it. Yeah. Because it's immune to those simple readings. And this is why I think... when you try and explain it. I mean, I think there is a slightly satirical, there's a slightly sort of thematic element to Spring Breakers, but that's not what you should be looking for. It's not a satire. It's not...
I mean, we're talking about Corinne here. Like, I mean, I fucking love Kids. I don't even count that as a Harmony film. I fucking love Gummo. Like, Gummo's fucking amazing. Mr. Lonely, fucking Julian Donkey Boy. This dude knows his shit. And everyone came out of the woodwork to watch this film because it just had this buzz around it. I mean, like, anybody who's seen a Harmony Korine film knows that anybody who went to it expecting to see anything other than what they got had no idea what they were talking about then. They didn't know why they were buying their ticket, and they have absolutely no...
But the thing is that people are just really confused because, of course, it doesn't satisfy the pain and gain audience. They're just like, what the fuck is this? But it also doesn't satisfy a lot of, you know, kind of... the sort of middle brow film stuff. Like, what the fuck is this?
So it's got a very... It doesn't occupy a very clear space, but the reality is, like, this is a dude who Herzog messaged after he saw Gummo, said, "Hello, Harmony Korine, my name is Werner Herzog. I've just seen your film Gummo. You are the last foot soldier." There is a very good reason...
It's interesting that you talk about Herzog knighting his successors.
But really, that's...
But it's interesting...
Spring Breakers, to me, is it is the product of an antithesis to all of cinema in America at screen content and music video. Like, it doesn't make a comment either way on it. It's just a pure realization. It doesn't have to exist, like, in this justified... in diegesis with characters who have motivations. It's so impressionistic. It is that pure... visceral kind of sensory engagement flies by the seat of its pants the whole time, and that's why people say there's no meaning to it. But nor is there fucking meaning in any of those old conventions, which are now so fucking tired that they need to be put down. That's the strength of Spring Breakers. At least it just shows you something different. At least it actually has, whatever you can say about how much it does or doesn't mean anything, it has a beating heart unlike just about anything I've seen in a very long time.
Would you like to talk about its companion?
Oh, well, I'm really riled up now. I fucking love Spring Breakers, but yeah, no. Let's talk about our tied for fourth.
If telling the truth is not polite, then I guess we'll have to fight. Okay, well, the film that I slightly preferred to Spring Breakers and the film that Christian didn't like as much as Spring Breakers, that we both quite like...
We both quite like.
Was Her. Mm. All right, actually, Her could have gone so fucking wrong. It's a really twee idea.
It's a very original idea.
It's a very original idea.
I imagine reading that script, a lot of people would have been like, this is either going to go one way or another, but at the very least...
I have no loyalty to Spike Jonze as a filmmaker.
I hate...
adaptation.
Adaptation, and I hate Being John Malkovich. I haven't seen Where the Wild Things Are.
No, I haven't seen it either.
Comes out of, like, I fucking hate Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah, you so hate Charlie much. Kaufman.
We've established this. I don't think anybody would know this, but, like, in previous podcasts, particularly the adaptation podcast we did, I just talked about how much I fucking hate Charlie Kaufman.
Anyway, let's not talk about Charlie Kaufman, but Spike Jonze, you know...
But as a result, so I didn't have any feelings towards Spike Jonze.
The only thing that...
I was very curious to see what, like, he'd write himself.
And it's a dumb premise, really, when you get down to it. I mean, it's a dumb premise until you see the film. And the only thing that I really kind of made me want to see it was... Well, it's got Joaquin Phoenix in it.
And as we just mentioned, his performance is so good. It's a very unique kind of character to play, let alone the performance, because you are completely engaged to the film through him. Like, he is the channel through which all of, you know, your emotions go.
Yeah.
But the thing is that he's so mopey, but you're still there.
You get inside his head. Yeah, exactly. But this is the thing is, and it's amazing... Her, because what So one of the criticisms, and this is what I love about her, is that this criticism, you know, can stand and it makes the film really interesting, is that basically, like, her is 500 Days of Summer on crack. It's the ultimate deconstruction of sort of the manic pixie dream girl, the woman who is the idol of the man.
The complete construction of his fantasy.
Exactly. The complete construction, and also, you know, and how that this is the breakup film sort of, you know, just taken to its nth degree. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that's very reductive. But even so, that's a very interesting film.
Mm. And but, like, there is a point to that, to viewing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and that's interesting. But I think what, you know, Jones had... Is it Jones or Jones?
Jones.
It's Jones. Jones had this idea, and he was saying, I was reading in an interview in Sight and Sound, that he... The film kind of grew for him when he realized that this isn't a fanciful sci-fi idea. Because it's not about we're so reliant on technology, this is where we're heading. It's not that. It's not about the sci-fi. It purely is the greatest on-screen representation of a love story. Mm. Truly. Blue is the warmest color, you know. Are there any other good love stories this year? Any cinematic love story, it can't compare to her.
It is very unique.
Because her understands that in any other film, sensuality will take over. You know, we have this problem is blue is the warmest colour, you know, of the gaze and how inconsistent that was. And in any film, it's always reduced to either sensuality or it's reduced to conversation or it's, you know, it's reduced to this idea of chemistry and this very superficial representation of relationships that is, you realize, is inherent in the form. I mean, this is just such a flaw in cinema. And her, by having a character that you follow around where the Scarlett Johansson character is in his head, so that where Blue is the Warmest Color is tightly following along, you know, one character, this manages to do that to two. And so you get this incredible intimacy surrounding the two characters, and it's unparalleled of how it creates this relationship. Yeah. And also what could have been a very visually dull film, you have the brilliant art direction, but you also have the way he's positioned around people, and that's ultimately what this film is. It's just about people in relation to other people, and often the way they... You know, it's subtly reminded of how he fits into the world around him. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I found really brilliant about this as well was the way it kind of, for the first time, well, maybe not for the first time, but at least to this degree, kind of acknowledges the kind of different mechanisms for intimacy that we now have in that realm as well. And it's kind of I didn't even think that anybody sees it as like, oh no, that damages storytelling. It's not about true love. Let's alienate that. It's just that nobody really knows how to incorporate it. And I haven't seen it really done well yet. People like trying to incorporate social media and stuff like that. But the way Jones has done it by like actually making it, you know, still quite, I don't think there's any reading of texts or any text like instant messaging of that kind, which is kind of what it feels like a lot of the time, because there's that connect to the person in the very simple fact that you're communicating with them, but in the pure sense of the physical, you know, the sharing a space physically with a person, the proximity to them.
But like the thing that is alienated. But the thing is, her sort of it removes.
He finds a way to make that work on screen.
He does.
And communicate that kind of alienation while simultaneously having some kind of connection. And to me, the film is really just about, not necessarily just on that love story level, but is really about intimacy and is about, I don't want to talk to 6,000 people, I want to talk to you.
Yeah, but I also think that it gets around the question of, you know, by having the computer in her head, sorry, in his head, it strips him of an internal monologue. It strips him of any sense of being alone. And, you know, in terms of, like, a love story, it's, you know, you have no alone time. You don't have any... You don't have yourself. You are one thing. And it's... And, of course, also, what I think people just completely leave behind is that his relationship with Samantha perfectly mirrors the relationship with his first wife. Mm. He talks about how he helped this, you know, he knew this girl from when she was young, he helped her grow, and then she became sort of smarter than him and outgrew him, which is exactly what happens to Samantha. You know, he literally sort of creates her with the software he has, and then at the end. And then they reach the singularity.
She's post-verbal.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, is that everyone's been saying it's interesting, this idea of the singularity. I'm like, no, it's not. The singularity really moment is sort of just a bit of window dressing. Ultimately, the singularity is just that somewhat, perhaps, inevitable moment where a relationship is sort of one person grows past the other.
Yeah.
And it's an amazingly moving movie. I mean, I just remember that when we were watching it, I was sitting next to this couple, and this woman just the whole time was going, what is this? This is the stupidest film. You know, he's in love with his computer. Like, I heard at one point, why is he wearing those pants? By the end, she was wrecked. Everyone was wrecked. I have never seen a cinema
that's beautiful.
That was has had that many people cry, more so than Toy Story 3.
That's
so really funny. Really good film, really original.
What I also really like is that, just on the perspective, just because, like, it is a really interesting thing to have a film kind of, if it's not bound by the male gaze, then at the very least, it has, it's aware of the fact, like, you know, Freddie is very much that, he's a romantic lead, and then Samantha comes into the picture. But so much of the male gaze is about that exactly. It's about gazing and having that kind of, like, looking while not being looked at, and the pleasure of, you know, looking at this thing. And that's completely removed. So, as a result, the film feels a lot healthier.
Oh, so much. And that's the thing.
Romantic
comedies and romance is always about watching from afar and love at first sight.
And then you're just like, wait a minute,
even
that's
Louis
fucked
the Warmest
up.
Colour is all about that missed gaze.
And yeah, and like they see, like they meet in the club, and then she's looking at her, and then she's looking at her, and they're gazing from afar, and you're just like, oh, look at them. Look at all beautiful people looking at each other.
And
like,
that's
no.
The thing. Movies can be sensual. They've never really been romantic. And her, I think, is honestly groundbreaking in the sense that it manages to convey that relationship in that he lets her into his life without them ever seeing each other. You know, it's
exactly. And I mean, it's one thing to kind of, as we were kind of talking about, as I mentioned before, the physical, but it's that thing about it's one thing to not be able to touch someone. It's another thing to not be able to see someone.
Yeah.
But still be able to trust the essence of that human and still connect with them is a really, like, that the difficulty of that is really the difficulty of intimacy.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, the real beauty of this, that you know, while being very, like, the finger is really on the pulse, you have that feeling seeing this film, is that it is really of the moment. There is still something very kind of transcendent to it, which is about just the difficulty of trying to connect with another person. Like, whatever time you're from.
Exactly. I think it's actually a really timeless film.
Yeah, exactly. But while still having very specific qualities too.
I think you could. Her's a very healthy film.
It does feel a lot healthier. Yeah.
It feels like eating a really well done stir fried vegetable.
In what it engenders in you, not necessarily in having relationships with your computer. Like, we're not taking that literalist.
Yeah, but the film itself, yeah.
I don't care.
It's completely fanciful. Like, yeah, it's not obviously exploring how we fall in love with computers. And I think anyone who thinks that, it's just completely missing what's brilliant about the film.
Yeah. And also, just on, like, healthy evasion of a certain convention, I felt like it's stated early on that like, she asked him why his relationship with his wife ended, and he says, like, oh, development, you know, like a relationship develops and everything. I, like, naturally just working overtime, like, my brain's just kind of going all the time watching something, so I instantly projected, like, a different set of, like, oh, well, like, if this ends with, like, oh, you know, we had some fun together, but I've developed and I've learned everything I can from you, and she's like, yeah, I've learned stuff from you too, okay, bye, as if, like, they're vessels to, like, be sapped, like a relationship is a swarm of locusts, and you come down and you take everything you can and then you leave. Like, I was just like, if that fucking happens, I'm going to fucking murder someone. Because I bet someone gave that to him as a note or something. Like, maybe it'd be cool. Like, and it's like, fuck off.
No,
and to
but
see
the
that that didn't
because,
happen.
Because he...
And
he,
you see it moving away from that for, like, the entire point.
It's the way the relationship's set out is that he's the one who initially informs her and creates her identity. Yeah. And then slowly she becomes herself from other influences.
And
then
she's the one to
they reach the singularity.
Yeah. I love that, like, I'm sorry, it's not you, it's me, I've reached the singularity.
Yeah, I know.
It's just a really funny, like, idea.
But it's really well done.
Also, Amy Adams is brilliant in this as well.
Yes. Is it her best performance of the year, Christian? Why don't we go to our award?
Wait a minute, just quickly. I'd just like to point out as well, when he's with Amy at the end, and he just got his head on her shoulder. I was just like, if they fucking kiss right now, I'm going to fucking go ballistic. And I was just like, if they do anything other than just like have a really simple end here, like it just ended just really just nicely.
Yeah. Not just spoiler or anything. I trusted the movie by that point. But yeah, I know.
But also just quickly, just a tiny note. Theodore Twombly kind of feels like a different side of the same coin to Freddie Quell to me in a weird way.
Who's Freddie Quell?
The Master.
Oh. Oh, no. See, maybe. But, like, I mean, I essentially came out of it thinking, good, Joaquin Phoenix has brain. He's not just intense all the time. And it is.
Also, a point worth mentioning was that that was with Amy Adams as well.
Yes, that's true.
I know. How much did you just completely forget that fact? And
that's another really good role from Amy Adams.
Yeah, and that's another Megan Ellison.
And also R.I.P.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, I suppose we should. Phillips.
Well, there we go.
I didn't realize how affected I was by that.
That's sad.
Yeah, no. But anyway, another Megan Ellison. So are we going to
So, well, let's talk about the award for... We had our regrets about seeing... What are the films you had no regrets about a film? What's a film that Hollywood... What's a film, sorry, that the Academy insists you should see that you did not see and you're proud of it?
All is Lost.
What?
All is Lost. That Robert Redford. The one that looked like a cross between Gravity and Life of Pi minus visual splendor.
Yeah.
Plus 70-year-old white dude. Like, no, I don't give a shit. I don't care how spellbinding or tour de force Robert Redford is. No, I'm not watching that.
It's written by
J.C. Chandler, who wrote Margin Call, which was actually quite overrated. Like, I think
you highly underrated the visual quality of Margin Call.
No, it looked fine, but it wasn't that amazing.
I really like Margin Call, which is
it was interesting. I'm glad I saw it, but it wasn't like...
isn't quite up there for me. And I don't think it's out yet.
Either way, it's a completely different story to the point where it might as well like be a first-time director.
Yeah, I'm going to... Maybe I'll see it. But no, I doubt it. I have...
If you see it, I'll buy you a beer.
Well, anyway, I possibly am not seeing the Best Picture winner if everything turns to shit.
God.
I did not, and very deliberately did not, see David O. Russell's American Hustle. I watched the trailers. I've had it described to me by several people I trust and witness, and it just sounds like Scorsese light. And I'm sick of people telling me it's amazing when they haven't fucking watched Goodfellas. More to the point, Scorsese's playing on in the cinema next door. Go see Wolf of Wall Street. I don't want to see David O. Russell. Silver Linings Playbook was a cookie cutter piece of crap. It was just a romantic comedy. I don't need to see Hairpiece 2013.
After we do our number three pick, we've got Most Overrated. So we might be talking about that.
Yeah.
But yeah. Also, point to make, because it's interesting. We just talk about Her and The Master. They're all linked because they're all produced by super producer Megan Ellison.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Which is interesting that she also produces turds like American Hustle.
I can see why.
I can see why, but like it's just a bit disappointing because David O. Russell's just... I loved I Heart Huckabees, but he's just a tool now.
I know. He's just like that kid in class that you're like, you know, you're a good-looking guy. You got a lot of talent. You just need to, if you applied yourself, David.
Applied yourself. Get a point of view.
Applied yourself, David.
What do you want to do?
Did you see The Fighter?
What do you think? What's your opinion about this?
Yeah.
No.
I've actually heard very good things about that, and that does look more...
Three Kings is great, but it's still just like a romp.
Yeah, he's just...
He just does romps. Anyway, we should...
Fuck David O. Russell. Let's talk about our number three, which is not a romp.
It is not a romp.
This is the film, I think, that... It's 12 Years a Slave. But I say John was a preacher cause my Bible says so too. I say roll, my soul arise in heaven, Lord, for the year when Jordan roll. Hallelujah, roll, Jordan roll. My soul arise in heaven, Lord, for the year when Jordan rolls. Hallelujah.
Roll, Jordan, roll. My soul arise in heaven, Lord, for the year when Jordan rolls.
Christ in heaven, Lord, for a year when
Jordan. All right, so 12 Years a Slave is our number 3 pick. Fuck, it's hard to talk about.
It's very difficult to
But 12 Years a Slave, it's sort of the kind of can't-lose film of 2013. I don't say that in a cynical way. It's an extremely important subject.
It's an extremely important subject.
Done with incredible sensitivity, yet not a hint of sort of sentimentality. It is extremely violent in an appropriate way, yet it is never sadistic. It's kind of perfect in that way.
The only criticisms that you really see leveled against this, that it's too beautiful, that it is too aesthetic, that
I just don't find McQueen that beautiful, so I don't have that issue. I mean,
you don't see any kind of aesthetic, kind of painterly quality to any of his images?
Yeah, in an ugly sense.
Well, yeah, but that's the point. It's he's a Turner Prize winning artist. Like,
yeah, you know, but I think it's more of a sense of control than a sense of aesthetic pleasure. Yeah.
I just like to make a point, like, on that, because, like, I have kind of...
Before you start, I would like to point out, I really don't like Steve McQueen that much.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I think Shame is massively overrated.
I love Hunger and Shame.
Furthermore, like, 12 Years a Slave, I love it, and I love what he did, but I didn't come out of it going, I love Steve McQueen now. I'm like, that's what Steve McQueen has done.
Yeah.
And I still don't... Like, you know, 12 Years a Slave, you can't not respect it and not feel something from it, but... It's not a filmmaking style I personally respond to. Still don't.
Right. Yeah. I think there are moments in Steve McQueen. Like, I love it when you know, a shot holds. I love that because there's a certain kind of tension to that which is completely different from any other tension you can manufacture with score or, you know, and performance or any kind of thing like that. So there is a certain kind of tension in that, and the would be like the nearly lynching is really astonishing to watch.
Oh yeah.
And like the only criticisms I've seen people level at that, they're just like, oh, he's too unflinching. Like, well, you do realize, like, just like he just detracts from the movie because he's being too unflinching. You're like, you do realize that it's your fault. Like that's kind of seen as that. Like, if you just shut up, that wouldn't even be a perceived problem. It's not a problem to me.
Oh, I mean, I think this film is, and once again, I say this in a way that's not cynical. It's critic proof. I mean,
I don't think it is though, because I've seen a lot of critics kind of talk about how, you know, even when it depicts inhuman cruelty, it never compromises its aesthetic purity, as if that's a really distracting thing from it. If you think that there's no possibility of balancing critical involvement and emotional involvement, then why the fuck are you a film critic?
But
McQueen's work really focuses on the body, like. Hunger is about a dude starving himself, watching him go through that, and watching both the unification of body and mind. Shame is about the clash between body and mind, and, you know, the kind of physical rapacity of this really entitled dude. 12 Years a Slave is about the will of this man who is continuously physically and psychologically broken. What happens to him? It's not something that you need to see the whips cracking on his back or like, I don't know what they want to see. Like,
yeah,
I don't understand the mentality that because it looks a certain way and because you are some kind of distance from it, that you can't relate to the physical sensation, like just intuitively of that is fucked. You get involved with it. I just don't understand the mentality that because it is so aesthetically contrived, and that's not said like with a negative connotation, is that the contrivance of it somehow subtracts from the emotion and the physicality of it.
I find that such an overstated aspect of the film, because I mean he's very in control of the camera, but you know it's not like we're seeing sort of shots of blood, you know, dripping off the leaves or something like that. It's control isn't necessarily. A lot, you know, for instance, half of the shot is out of focus most of the time. That's a very McQueen thing. So I don't...
It's also shot by Sean Bobbitt, who shot Place Beyond the Pines, by the way.
Interesting. Yeah. I know which film he did a better job for.
Yeah.
I think it's critic-proof in the sense that every criticism of it kind of... I guess that is sort of, you know, if you think that, that is... But I just don't see it in the film. Yeah, I don't see McQueen doing that. I don't see how you can find anything about it particularly visually stunning. It's controlled, and the way he leads the camera helps you appreciate the kind of horrors of the era. But, I mean, short of just doing fucking Dogma slavery or something, I mean, what the hell do you want?
I mean, I kind of love the kind of... There is a certain degree of coldness to it, of that kind of observer, which I just, you know, I love. Like, it's just... It's
yeah, but when he needs to get in there, he gets in there when it needs to be. Like, absolutely. When the camera spins around Patsy.
That long take with the whipping.
Yes, exactly. Like, he does that. That's not just him showing off. That's him kind of, you know, it's the best way for you to kind of experience this particular act. And yeah, I think all of the choices are very economical. And I don't think there's ever a sense of aesthetics getting the better of him. And I find that just a complaint that kind of feels like you read Steve McQueen's biopic, didn't see the movie and thought, well, this is going to be my problem, hypothetically.
Hmm. Well, yeah, but, like, people have, like, the main kind of criticism I've seen leveled against it is kind of... I think it's interesting that other people is the criticism is, for me, the basis of why I love it so much. And I think it's kind of, you know, it's kind of... It's really kind of... People kind of attack that authorial viewpoint that is generally inclined to stand back and observe. Like, I mean, I suppose... What I'm kind of thinking of is like a Haneke kind of eye, which is, you know, very kind of divorced from the action, which I suppose the difference is doesn't necessarily have any sympathy whatsoever for what's going on within the frame. But,
there's a similarity to McQueen and Haneke in a way.
Yeah. It's about that eye, but I suppose where like Haneke is completely dissociative, like with relationships with the characters, is that McQueen allows you to project a lot. And I read that... Chiwetel Ejiofor and McQueen, when they were talking about performance and references, they were talking about Buster Keaton and the unreadability and blankness of his expression being a universal signifier upon which you project a great deal of baggage.
I think it's also worth talking about what's brilliant is that how all the black characters in that film... for the sake of verisimilitude, you know, you need to completely strip them of any agency, which he does, because that's what happened. But also you need to retain their sense of character, which is an extremely hard thing to do. I still don't know exactly how he managed to pull that trick off. But so, you know, they completely have no sense of self, yet they manage to still be three-dimensional characters populating the film. Furthermore, I think that he never excuses the white characters on the basis of it was the time.
Oh, it's crazy 1800s.
It's so obvious in Fassbinder's performance that he is deliberately... And this is something that I think a lot of people have commented on in slavery and racism, is that in order for that economic system to be somewhat viable, you know, you needed to dehumanize them, as in...
And that's something that comes through in
their performances. Fassbinder is that it's like he kind of, in his drunken stupor, he constantly has to remind himself that they're property. It's not like this is something he essentially believes, and I think that's a really superficial reading of it. No, he constantly has to. He's not just about convincing other people that, you know, these people are property. He has to convince himself, which I think is one of the most interesting aspects. And I hope it doesn't get overlooked.
I suppose, like, that's the thing is that, like, when you hear McQueen kind of talk about it, he's calling it an American film. He's not calling it a black American film or a white American film. He's calling it an American film because, to that degree, there is also the massive problem, which is still rife, of just the commodification of humans. And just, like, the role of commodification and the human experience and everything. And just viewing people as property, as, you know, a kind of illness of a certain cultural kind, which really kind of rings true in a really uncomfortable way still, even if it is manifested in a different way than the purchasing and dealing of people. It's still a very kind of prescient kind of theme upon which he hits.
Yeah. Well,
and again, almost in a way, like we're talking about the American kind of... economic situation and everything. It does kind of feel like an oddly kind of, you know,
but it never puts too fine a point on it, which is important. No, but I think even in a direct sense, slavery hangs over America. You don't need to tie that into sort of a modern political or social climate to make it relevant. It still is. Yeah. I mean, that still haunts America. So there are people on, you know, YouTube. I don't know why I did that. But there are people on YouTube, you know, saying this is an anti-white film. You know, there's a lot of... There is still controversy over this film or the way it treats its white characters, as unbelievable as it sounds.
No, fuck off.
Exactly. Exactly. And but that's what I'm saying. And I think this... And I think, you know, that's why this film is so important. And thank God that it's this film and not, like, the Black Schindler's List. It's a film divorced of sentimentality. It's a film that doesn't pull any punches. It hammers home the fact that most of these people aren't getting out. So,
you know,
this film had to happen. Thank God it was this one.
Mm. Also, the punch of the final line is, you know, there's nothing to forgive is insane.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, like, that mindset just kind of like, just, it's, I mean, it's just it's a gut punch. It's a really important gut punch. And anybody who's like saying it's anti-white is just taking a rather simplistic view of a very complex issue that they need to think about and they need to kind of really...
It's taking a stance against anyone who kind of...
Isn't
ashamed of slavery, basically. If you're not ashamed of slavery, then... Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. See, talking about it, just... It's such... feels important, like it feels
in the good sense. Anyway,
brilliant film.
Let's
move to
our
most overrated.
Most overrated.
Most overrated. Yep. I think I'll just go quickly now because I can spew a whole heap of bile about it. But American Hustle is all Sheen. It is ripping off Scorsese, and not even just Scorsese. It's also ripping off a fucking contemporary in PTA, like. The Boogie Nights, like, he kind of just went like...
To be fair, Boogie Nights is a Scorsese homage.
Well, yeah, exactly. But that's the point, is that he's not even, like, going straight to the source half the time. He's going via someone else ripping off Scorsese. But the thing, like, he's got... It doesn't even... Like, people say, oh, visual, it's so amazing, it looks amazing. No, it fucking doesn't. It's focusing on a lot of detail. But the way it's shot is abysmal. It's just of, like, a roaming Steadicam on... You know, like a really, like, quite wide lens for almost the whole thing. The whole thing is shot like that. There is no visual dynamic, like, no visual dynamics whatsoever. There is absolutely no variation. There's, like, maybe one close-up shot on Amy Adams in, like, the first 5 minutes, which I remember. And then apart from that, it's just absolute torpor cinema photographically. The thing is that he shoots and he shows us all these teeth. And this hair and these clothes, he doesn't show you any people. There's nothing beneath it. That's the point, is that this film about bullshit, it was supposed to be called American Bullshit at the beginning. It is bullshit. It is just, it would be fine. See, this is my problem with it. It would be fine if it was about teeth and hair and really cool clothes. But it's not. It's about the fact that all these people are inherently, like, you know, empty. But they've got this sheen, but they should have something inside. And then at the end, oh my God. Okay, so basically, you can't just have a film, just say, like, for 2.5 hours, like, oh, it's a disco ball, but it's hollow. And then just for 2 hours, just go, oh, look at the lights floating off the disco ball. It's amazing. And then tack on at the end, like, oh yeah, but the disco ball was hollow. So, we got out of that and then we had a kid and then we got the kid a cake because cakes have layers. Like, you can't do that. It's just not allowed.
I know. And it sounds like
you have to be competent. That is the only thing that I demand, is that if you make a point, that you fucking back it up. Like, you don't go away at the end and say, like, oh yeah, but that wasn't, you know, that wasn't the straight road, but they got in the straight and narrow and yeah, everything worked out fine. Like, thanks for tacking that on literally in the last 30 seconds. It's absolutely obscene how much shit they, like, load on and then try to get away with. Like, the problem is he doesn't have a viewpoint. He doesn't have a fucking opinion. Like, with Scorsese, you have the irony and you have the sense that he has, like, he looks at this guy and goes, that guy's fucked.
But he would never tell the audience what to think. He would just show it.
See, this is the thing, like,
Russell tells the audience what to think, even though he doesn't really think anything himself.
But he doesn't tell you what to think. He just tells you to look at it and go, oh, it's a disco ball. But the thing is, like, there's this... the reason he's Scorsese light, and it comes down to music choice. He gets all these, like, 70s, like, and Boogie Nights, like, all these, like, roller rink, like, those kind of, like... those things on, like, Led Zeppelin ripoffs and all that stuff, but he just plays it over everything. Like, there's no discretion. Like, this moment needs some irony, like these people building themselves up. No, it's just over fucking everything.
Which,
like,
is also true of Silver Linings Playbook, which is ironic because I love the songs in that film, but they're used terribly.
They're so, like, the thing, like, there's just this bit where Jeremy Renner, who I actually, he was the only character I kind of liked, but only when he realized he was fucked, and he was just like, it was mainly because it was the first time I've seen any emotion out of Jeremy Renner in a film. I was like, oh, he can act.
But hey, the thing is, hey man, Hawkeye. Okay. His backstory with Black Widow.
But the thing is, like, there's this one bit where he, like, comes out and does that, like, politician of just like, hey man, we're going to do this and it's going to be great. Like, because, I mean, but the thing is, of course, we have the dramatic irony as the audience of knowing that, oh, it's not going to be great. But the thing is, he still plays, like, that rock and roll thing underneath it, the same way that he unironically and ironically does for the rest of it, that there is no actually distinguishing what he's trying to get at. You're just like, dude, that is just terrible. What are you doing? But the thing is, it has that frenetic pace, and it just moves along so quickly, you're just like, oh, disco balls, yeah. You just, like, go along with it. But then you come out of it and go, wait, that was fundamentally unsatisfying.
So no. Basically, it's kind of like when you get really drunk and eat a lot of Macca's cheeseburgers.
Yes.
It's the cinematic that is it. And then wake up and go like, oh, no, not good.
So basically, like...
All right.
My gripe. I think that's a fair gripe to have.
No, but it also, I just think what you described is fundamentally like the Academy Awards in a nutshell. Yeah. Like, no. No, but seriously, guys.
God.
Well, I mean, my pick for underrated is... overrated is a difficult one. Because, I mean, it's obviously Frozen. Because people apparently liked Frozen, and they shouldn't. Because it's a piece of shit. But that seems, you know, that's the worst film of the year, and I feel like it's a bit boring, you know, contrasting that with overrated. So I'm going to choose a film that I actually do more or less like, but it is slightly overrated, and that is the indie film that could. There's always got to be an indie film that could. Short Term 12.
Yeah.
It's a very nice film. It should have been so much better. They're fucked. Everyone in that film is fucked. And the film never has the balls to admit it.
Yeah.
Like, the fucking violent, suicidal kid that at the end is suddenly... Oh, spoilers alert. Oh, by the way, he's now dating that girl.
He's now dating that girl who thought was cute.
And I just find it sort of offensive that this girl is being sexually molested. They destroy the dad's car and everything's right as rain. No, she's fucked up for the rest of her life, you know. It's sort of nice. See? It's not nice. Because whenever you describe a film about people as damaged as the people in Short Term 12, it should never be nice.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, just thinking about it, that film's even more annoying than I took it for. It's too nice for its own good.
Yeah, I remember when I came out of it, I was like, oh, this is a lot better than I expected it might be, and it actually distinguishes itself. But, like, in the time since,
I've been like... down the more I've been like,
wait, has that even stuck in my mind remotely? No. No, it hasn't.
And there's a great film about those group homes waiting to be made, and it's not this one.
Good
performances.
Really good performances.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm kind of curious to see what the director does next, because he was a social worker in one of these
homes.
So, like, it's obviously his story to a degree. I mean, there are things kind of thrown in there for, like, screenplay structure.
But if you think about the fourth season, The Wire, which is beautiful because it's taking that same story about people who have very little hope, and then it gives you the uplifting story of people who try, and in many ways they fail, but you still get the humanity from the trying, and that's all you need in these stories. You just need... It doesn't have to be eminently depressing and hopeless with, you know... You can have something slightly uplifting without everyone just turns out well.
Yeah.
You can be abused and abandoned and suicidal, but you'll be happy in the end because this is a movie and we've only got 90 minutes. So
we've essentially both gone at the gone against them because they quite disingenuously tack on a happy ending, which is out of place for the body of the film in a way.
Well, yeah, but doesn't American Hustle even more insidiously tack on
crap.
Moral?
It tries to tack on a moral, saying that it's got a moral heart, but because it does that, it kind of reveals itself to be completely empty.
See, Short Term 12 is well-intentioned, disingenuous.
Yeah.
So, you know,
but
whatever that's worth. Speaking of disingenuous people, let's get to number two, The Wolf of Wall Street.
My name is Jordan Belfort. The year I turned 26, I made $49 million, which really pissed me off because it was three shy of a million a week.
We're making a name for ourselves.
Nobody knows if the stock is going to go up, down, sideways, or in circles. You know what a Fugazi is?
Well, Fugazi. It's a fake.
Yeah, Fugazi, Fugazi. It's a wazi, it's a woozy, it's a fairy dust.
Was all this legal? Absolutely not. We were making more money than we knew what to do with.
We don't work for you, man.
Yeah, my money taped to you, Goose. Technically, you do work for me.
What's wrong, Daddy? But watching you
bring home. Oh, my God.
FBI, any kind of booze you might want?
No, the Bureau forbids us from drinking.
So follow me, you could by the door. I'm doing 500, I'm out of control. But there's nowhere to go.
You know what a Fugazi is?
Fugazi.
It's a woozy.
Nobody can do that except for the one man who did it, Matthew McConaughey.
Another brilliant medal in the McConaissance that is going on. So The Wolf of Wall Street is the most controversial film of the year, I think I can say with some confidence.
Yep.
And everyone who thinks it's controversial, when are you going to learn? When you history always frowns on you people, the people that find Scorsese's films morally reprehensible. We had this with Mean Streets, with Taxi Driver, with Raging Bull, with Goodfellas, all classics, and all the people who contemporaneously said, no, it's just excessive. You were wrong. And you're wrong about Wolf of Wall Street. This is another masterpiece.
I love Wolf of Wall Street so much. It's just like... I mean, you, to a degree, you get it. And you understand, like, yeah, I get you guys that you don't dig it. And I mean, to be fair, in Wolf of Wall Street, I think this is kind of the thing that makes it so strong, is that after so long and kind of things like, you know, just a bit of Hugo and a bit of Departed, which, you know, wasn't a kid's film by any stretch of the imagination, but they weren't as kind of, you know... really kind of straying into very nasty territory like a lot of those other Scorsese films. And that's the thing with Wolf of Wall Street. Not only does it do that, but it actually kind of goes beyond and a lot further than even those crazier, more terrible, horrible films of his. Which is, you know... It's odd because it's good to see that he's still got that in him and that, you know, he's still active and doing stuff which will be part of the Scorsese, you know, lexicon beyond... his death, which I hope isn't soon. I hope he makes several more.
I know. I mean, Scorsese really does show no signs of slowing down or going soft. Or, I mean, his ratio of sort of good to bad films is pretty much as consistent as it's ever been.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the closest he's come to a dry spell was the 80s.
late 90s, like Bringing Out the Dead and stuff like that.
I guess that's that in the 80s, and even then, you know, there's still good films in there.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, he's punctuated it with masterpieces, one of which is The Wolf of Wall Street.
And absolutely, I agree, and I think it's worth mentioning right now that Cavaliers Do Cinema will be doing a Scorsese retrospective in 4 or 5 parts.
It's going to be a long one, we're going to be doing it by decade. So look out for that.
But, so Wolf of Wall Street. Now, I must say, when I walked out of this film, this 3-hour film, now, I'd just like to address something. Why do people have this really intense aversion to long films? A long film that has a pace like this, which is so, so tight and so, like, intense. Like, half the point of it, you know, the excessive runtime is completely... complementary to the content, which is completely excessive. So it kind of makes sense that, like, they're talking about, like, days where they take enough drugs to sedate
Manhattan. Yeah.
Like, you know, the pace is intense. Like, they say they had to cut it down from 4 hours. They couldn't get it down to 2. Like, other people saying, like, yeah, you could have just cut out all the 5-minute scenes where nothing happens. Like, and lose Mark Hanna? No.
But more than anything, I mean, that, as people pointed out, if you had made this film into something easily digestible, if they had been these really neat snippets, it would have been a film that would endorse Jordan Belfort, that would glorify him. It would have been essentially like American Hustle. You know, it would have been this glitzy, you know, little tour of, okay, I'm just going to spend some time with people who are richer than me, but it's all right because they're bad people, and then walk out. But because you're forced to really just immerse yourself in a life of excessive wealth and debauchery, but still a life that is successful.
So empty.
You're so empty, yet, you know, superficially has no real kind of comeuppance.
Yeah, and I must say, I mean, of course, that's like a Scorsese. I mean, obviously, it's unavoidable to compare this to Goodfellas, obviously.
Completely.
I mean, if there's one film, like, within the history of cinema that this is comparable to, really, like, really almost owes a lot to, it is Goodfellas. But not in, but almost in a sense, like, Scorsese responding to that and almost going, yeah, I can better that now, like, 20 years on, which is really, really impressive.
I know, and it's he needs to reuse that style, but he's using it for a point. But I think what's interesting is that in the character of Jordan Belfort and the people around it, it's a very Scorsese thing, and that really hyper virile masculine, you know, really selfish, horrible person. We've seen this in Jake LaMotta. We've seen it in
it's a very specific kind of Scorsese pro antagonist kind of
Henry Hill,
incredible anti-hero,
Nicky to an extent, you know, all the characters. The difference is and I think this is kind of Scorsese, you know, for the first time he's actually looking around and gone, shit, this is worse than I thought. Because in Goodfellas and Raging Bull and Taxi Driver's a bit different because it's Psychosis, but Mean Streets as well, they're all tragedies. They're all about characters that are brought down by these flaws in them. And these flaws are kind of tied in with their charms, but it's also like, you know, he thinks that there's this essential masculine rage that just will always bring these people down. But in Wolf of Wall Street, it doesn't. It doesn't. And I think Scorsese, it's his most cynical film. And I mean that in a way of not cynical in the same way David O. Russell's cynical, but I mean that in a way in that he expects more and he feels, you know, worn down by the point, because he's saying, no, I'm still making these films. This time, you're not going to get the comeuppance. You're not going to get the fall. Jordan Belfort is still out there.
They keep getting away with it.
And
that's kind of what makes it so horrifying. I think kind of what, I mean, makes a lot of people I've talked to who have problems with the film have problems with both the fact that they kind of talk about how it's a bit of an anticlimax, that after 3 hours, then that's just all that happens. But I think that's just really disguising the fact that everyone, like, does get really pissed off that there is no comeuppance. But that's the point. Like, you look at the body of work where there is always some degree of comeuppance, and, you know, there is an obvious sense of, even if they're still on top, to some degree they've lost everyone, they've lost major parts of themselves. With Jordan Belfort, he's still selling you shit. And that's the thing, is that he's still being exactly who he is. He's still being that con man, but he's just doing it with pens in New Zealand.
But of course, the genius of it is, and you know, slight spoiler, we have to discuss the final shot is one of the most brilliant things in Scorsese.
Absolutely.
Because it pans across and you see all these dorks who are hanging on to every one of Jordan Belfort's words, and you realise,
I like this pin. It's a very nice pin.
And you realise, you know, Jordan Belfort's still selling shit. He's just sold you something. You've just become part of the Stratton Oakmont team. You've bought into his myth. You have given over 3 hours of your life to watch his debauchery. And it's just kind of this massive fuck you. And it's like, you want the comeuppance, but you're not going to get there, because no matter what, you will keep watching.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's a massive indictment.
And it's so nice to see Scorsese end that film with that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so good.
And particularly because it ends in a way very similar to Goodfellas. Because Goodfellas, of course, ends with My Way by the Sex Pistols. Yeah. And this ends with Mrs. Robinson by the Lemonheads. So it's
not quite, well, I mean...
Yeah, well, exactly. So the closing montage happens and you think... And Jordan Belfort, you presume, is giving his closing monologue a la Henry Hill in Goodfellas, where he's saying, you know, I was shit scared when I got to prison, da, da, da. And then he says, oh, but then I remembered, I was rich. And then suddenly you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, there's one crane shot going over a tennis court. Like, that's all there is of prison. Like, that's all... I mean, even like... Because Goodfellas, the prison sequence is like maybe 5 minutes, and it kind of just shows them living quite comfortably. But
the comeuppance in Goodfellas isn't prison, it's the end of the life.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But the thing is that... No. But it also makes the double point that he's still part of the life. Because, like, there's that moment where he, like, looks over his shoulder from the door. And then it's got Tommy DeVito doing the gunshot straight at the camera, which is in Dip of the Hat to the great train robbery from the 20s. Which is, you know, like, making the point that they're still much a part of that kind of American bastard badass mythologized criminal. Which is, you know... And then he kind of like winks at the camera or something, or smiles at the camera. So he's still a part of that. So he still has that. So even though he's had his comeuppance, he's still got this sense of like, haha, yeah, like I did get away with it to a large degree. But the thing is with this is that you get more of the sense that Belfort is putting it over on you, the audience, much more than Henry Hill does, which kind of makes it that much
and
more.
And that's what's like, and that's what I think why people are so angry about it is that, you know, he doesn't just cheat his clients, he cheats the audience. And I think that's a really right way to do it. But also I think, you know, I find so many of the criticisms just sort of ridiculous is, you know, well, he didn't get a comeuppance. This film is just excessive. It's long. It's boring. It's like, if you want to see these films, you know, start prosecuting the Jordan Belforts of the world. But they don't, you know. It's such a true to life film, such an accurate depiction of that culture. And in the end, when you come out, you go, this is a really important film. It's funny and it's crude and it's excessive, but it's an incredibly important, and just precise diagnosis of America. And we've had all these attempts, you know, we had the Gatsby, Spring Breakers is kind of like the impressionistic flip side of that. We've had The Great Gatsby and The Bling Ring, and we've had these very mannered morality tales that try and tackle the American hustle, trying to tackle this issue. And Scorsese is the first one to go, no, the sort of the Great Gatsby approach is no longer accurate. These are gross men out to do gross things for pure profit. And I think it's both extremely heartening as a Scorsese fan, but really sad in general that, you know, it takes this extremely old sort of canonized director who's the only one to really realize this and point it out.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the thing is that, I mean, you say as a Scorsese fan, and obviously I'm completely on that train with you, I think the one difficulty, the one thing that makes Scorsese problematic and the one criticism that I really kind of respond to is that he is an incredibly, you know, visually literate director, and he's very much a cinephile, and, you know, like, it's, you know, like in referring to stuff like The Great Train Robbery, and in all of his films, they're just layered with so many, you know, like the bump-ins come from Yojimbo, and, you know, like just all these kind of points in Scorsese that are so steeped in film history and all this stuff that you kind of need to have a wider depth of knowledge to kind of completely understand exactly a point he's making with a certain shot is that his films don't necessarily appeal to that audience. Like with Taxi Driver, because of the excessive violence you get in the Times Square crowd, like with Goodfellas, because it's a gangster pit, you get in a massive crowd. The thing is that Scorsese always draws audiences to his films that don't necessarily respond to the irony inherent in them. And he's such an ironic director. And I mean, that's the one danger of Scorsese. I mean, I suppose that's the great kind of question is that I see his films to be of tremendous social value if you understand them, but I've already seen a lot of fucking morons like posting Jordan Belfort quotes as their Facebook status.
I know, I completely agree.
That's the one difficulty of it is that, you know, and I mean, even to a degree, like, you have to admit that there is something insanely, like, because it is destructive and there is an element of cool to it, like, there is all, like, you know, there are self-destructive streaks in your own personality.
Exactly,
so, like,
but
to
that's
the point
the thing.
Where Jonah Hill said, when asked about, like, one of his favourite memories of working on set, he said, like, the first fake line of cocaine he snorted on a Scorsese movie kind of, like, gave him this kind of personal high because it was just, like, such a, you know...
I know, but I think... But that's the thing. Yeah. I think that's, you know, it would be disingenuous... And he's done this in his earlier films, and this has been a criticism level at him before, is that Scorsese wants to draw you inside the world. He's never going to... He always to make
they're,
sure...
They're documentaries of the mind as... on Taxi Driver, the cinematographer, I think it's Michael Chapman. Michael something.
Yeah, but I mean, more so...
He calls them documentaries of the mind, which I think is a really good kind of...
Exactly. And I think... I acknowledge those criticisms, but I kind of reject them because, I mean, for one thing, if you just show Jordan Belfort from an extremely removed angle where there's no appeal, there's no charm, there's no sense that people actually want to live like that, then it's an extremely shallow and sort of smug film. Mm. I mean, if people don't want to be like Jordan Belfort, then there wouldn't be any Jordan Belforts. Mm. And more to the point, I think that there, you know, people wouldn't respond to Jordan Belfort if they didn't already have that sort of ideal. I mean, yes, we know that, for instance, Gordon Gekko became this huge influence on Wall Street. And we know that there were Travis Bickle...
Well, John Hinckley Jr.
Yeah, John Hinckley and many others associated with those characters. But I think that just means he's obviously struck something very accurate. I don't think he's necessarily inspired any of those feelings. And to me, that just further points about why Wolf of Wall Street is so precise. But I think it makes it clear enough how grotesque it is.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. See, I'm just kind of, you know... I think, you know, obviously... I think it's a really important role of art, you know, to kind of bring about kind of different ways of seeing the world and, you know, broaden a person's perspective. And I don't think anybody, any director quite has the attitude to never judge a man until you've walked a mile in his shoes, quite like Scorsese.
Exactly.
So, you know, and I think that's one of the real strengths of Scorsese and something that I've always found quite beautiful in his work. But I mean, you...
As opposed to Michael Haneke, who judge a man when he's walked a mile in his shoes and you've stood there with the camera a mile
away. Well, yeah, exactly. But I mean, you know, it is quite... Having said that, I think what makes Wolf of Wall Street so unique is that after finishing it, I walked out with this odd sense of zen, which was like, that was a master at the peak of his game in the field that I want to, you know, devote my life to. But also... I will never be Jordan Belfort, and that is a nice feeling.
Yeah.
I will never, ever, ever be that guy. And I am glad that I will, you know, hopefully go further towards it. Well, having said that, though, like, Scorsese has been known to do...
A lot of blow. But, I mean, this is the thing I can't believe hasn't happened is that we haven't had a new Hollywood film about new Hollywood. We haven't had a sort of Wolf of Wall Street chronicling the rise and fall of that era because it's just so ripe.
Well, I mean, all the producers and directors who are part of that status quo and probably want it hushed up are still around. So give us another 20 years.
And we'll see sort of the...
I'd love to see that. No, it kind of feels like more of a TV series, though, which would be quite funny, though.
Yeah.
About the cinematic masters on like a really
snorting
long running...
Snorting lots of cocaine.
Like, lots of cocaine.
I think Wolf of Wall Street also, at the end of the day, it's so formally strong that at the very end, just simply...
Yeah, I had like one technical choice or hang up, which was like when the plane crashed, I would have rather that there was no voiceover. I mean, when the plane crashed, when they were on the boat and he sees the plane crash out the window, and I was just like... If there was, like, one thing, I was just like, he could have just sat there and watched it and we didn't have to be in his head necessarily because I felt by that point we were kind of, like, reasonably far detached from him. But, like, apart from that, that's pretty much, like, that's almost zen-like for me. Like, I never have, like, no, like, don't like that. I never, ever, ever get that watching a film. So that was nice.
Yeah, no, I think it was just I came out of it saying, you know, look, we'll see where this lands in... the greater scheme of things, it's perfect.
Yeah. I think also something that makes this different, I suppose, not necessarily, because, I mean, you know, he's done stories like this based, like, with anti-hero protagonists like this before, based on real characters, but never quite as funny as this. Like,
oh, no.
Raging Bull and Goodfellas are both very, very kind of... sensible, well, you know, with you know,
well, Goodfellas, I think, has the most humor of a film. Goodfellas and The Departed both have a lot of humor in them.
Yeah, but like this is like a dark comedy.
Yeah,
like, the difference being that this is not quite sad.
Like once
it's
again,
it's fucking hilarious.
It's like, not. Yeah. It doesn't fit into the genre of dark comedy or satire the way. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I think that.
Makes it so strong is that it is. I find it. I was laughing my head off the whole time.
Oh, yeah, so was
and,
I.
But, you know, like, the thing is, like, it has to be almost to a degree detached as hell. Like, when you've got that joke about the guy, like, getting head in the glass elevator.
Yeah.
They ended up married. Anyway, 3 years later, he killed himself.
I know.
You're just like, wait, so that did actually happen. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah,
just like,
I mean,
holy shit! Like, it kind of just becomes a whole different level of funny because it reminds you, like, oh, so real people were really hurt by this lifestyle as we're charging along through snorting more shit and dropping more quaaludes. Speaking of which, the lemon sequence is one of the funniest, most embarrassing, abominable kind of indictments of a wayward culture that I've seen in a while.
Yeah,
but
particularly
my
favorite moment is the Popeye cocaine.
The Popeye and the spinach. You're just like, that is such, like, I think any other, if that was just the beginning of a sequence, like on its own, like he's watching Popeye have spinach, therefore he has cocaine. You're like, that's funny.
But the way it's
8 minutes into this ridiculous sequence, and then it's just like, there's no way this sequence can get any better. And it just keeps getting better and better and better. And then it just kind of, like, you know, peaks with that. And then what I find so interesting about that is that in the whole kind of body of Scorsese's work, where just people do mountains of cocaine, nobody's ever just taken like a bowl of cocaine, poured it on their face, gone... and then just like kind of like, and then it just watches from afar as he beats his chest like a gorilla. You're like, that guy is fucked.
But it's just completely like, it's not sort of a Scarface-esque. It would have been interesting if Brian De Palma had done this film. It's not a Scarface-esque, just sort of like, look at my shit, I got, no, but it's not sort of just excess happening in a way that feels like the character could have shot it. You kind of completely believe that Belfort would have just chucked this bowl of cocaine on him and beat his chest. It feels completely lived in and believable. But, I mean, all of Scorsese's films do, and that's why he's so good. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that Scorsese contributed like no one else to cinema, is that he was one of the first to synthesize, in that way, a real lived-in, realistic verite quality with a kind of highly operatic, stylized film.
Yeah,
I don't know any director who combines it like Scorsese.
Mm.
I really don't.
That's a really good point, yeah.
You know, he was taking sort of Fellini and Cassavetes and combining them in his early career, and he's still kind of combining those...
To a degree, yeah.
...supposedly mutually exclusive styles and makes some of the most full-bodied films
there are. Absolutely, I think that's a really good point. Also, just on supporting cast now, because, like, that's... I mean, as much as, like, it's easy to kind of focus on Scorsese and, like, the authorial kind of fingerprints, and as always, a really, really strong, interesting male lead. The supporting cast to Scorsese are always amazing, and this one is no exception. Like, it's got just the right attitude to characters and actors. Like, just put them in when they're right. Include them as they are necessary, not based on billing or star power or anything like that. And it's always really nice to see that, because it's got a proper attitude to getting involved with the story and, like,
McConaughey just popping in.
He just pops in. Like, he doesn't have to come back. Like, he's just there for about a 10-minute period in the film with one scene. And then you're just like, that's the space that he has to occupy. Like,
yeah, and it's the same with Margot Robbie's character. She just kind of pops in to remind you of that other aspect of Jordan Belfort's life. She's almost... very much recalling Sharon Stone in Casino. She kind of makes you question, God, who's even worse in this relationship? Yeah.
But also, a couple of cameos. Spike Jones
is
the penny, the writer and director of Her, of course. Was the penny stock dude with pink slips at the very beginning, which is awesome. Which is just such a fun detail. John Favreau as the fixer, and a really fun one. Like the second, the last scene of the film where Jordan Belfort's doing his speaking tour in New Zealand, the person who announces Jordan Belfort is the real Jordan Belfort.
Which is, once again, just adds to how that scene is the key to unlocking the movie. It's, you know, Jordan Belfort is setting you up the whole time.
I mean, you know, and also, like, you know, Jonah Hill, we talked about him. Like, anybody with a word to say against Jonah Hill, past, present or future, can get fucked.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
He was amazing. Anyway, should we move on?
Oh, also, just quickly, I don't know if I mentioned this, but in his, like, I saw his Rotten Tomatoes top 5 films of all time.
Yeah,
he described Goodfellas as the perfect movie.
And
so.
I know, and I just like the fact not only that he got to work in a Scorsese film, but he got to work in this one.
Yeah, and, like, that's, like, he'll be... He'll be pinching himself for the rest of his life, which is kind of what makes me love him so much.
I know, and also the fact that he's now two-time Academy Award nominated, Jonah Hill.
Yeah.
Anyway, do you want to give out the saddest award of the podcast?
Can I just say quickly as well, just like on one point, O. Russell is scared of alienating people and Scorsese knows it's the point.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Also, Scorsese really doesn't care for plot. None of his movies have plot, except for Hugo, and it utilizes...
He hates plot, and that's why I love him.
Yeah.
I mean, amongst a couple other reasons.
Yeah.
But,
Should we go move on to the saddest awards?
Most disappointing.
Which we've kind of already said, but...
We have said, it is Gravity for me. But, I mean, like, not that I didn't enjoy it, I really did, but, like, I kind of just, waiting for it for 4 or 5 years, and then it didn't blow my brain all over the
cinema. Blow your little mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have two. As I said, Place Beyond the Pines was a massive disappointment for me because I feel like my disappointment is stronger than yours.
Yeah.
One thing, because I think you like Gravity more than I like Place Beyond the Pines. But, at the end of the day, Alfonso Cuarón, he's done great films.
Yeah.
And Blue Valentine was a great film, but it was made by a director who was still waiting to make that great film. Yeah. And I really thought Place Beyond the Pines is going to be that great film. I was really thinking this is going to be a modern American masterpiece.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. And I just hope Sean France does something amazing soon.
Mm. I think he's doing a couple documentaries now. But
I could see that.
Because he comes from documentary.
Yeah, I could see that working. The other film that I wanted... I was really looking forward to, but was quite disappointing, was Room 237, the documentary on The Shining. Because it's just very poorly executed. What's such a strong concept. I love The Shining. It's one of my favourite films of all time, and we had the good fortune to see it...
In a cinema. First time for me, 2 weeks ago.
On the big screen. And it's brilliant.
Sorry about that.
And the thing about Room 237 is it never really kind of gives you any perspective on what you're seeing. And what you're seeing are people who have basically lost their mind to The Shining. And it's a fascinating concept. What we're really seeing are people who have seen this film and have essentially been driven mad by it. And instead, it just is basically presenting their theories over the film. It feels like a YouTube video made by the people depicted in it. It's the raw materials of a documentary. It's not a finished film. And you'll learn some interesting things about The Shining, but it could have been so much better. That was a really disappointing film.
Oh, well.
Anyway, should we get to our...
Our number one.
So, So here it is, the number one film of the year, the official winner of the Cavi Award for Best Picture. It is, and the winner is Act of Killing.
Born free as free as the wind blows, as free as the grass grows. Born free to follow your heart. Live free, and beauty surrounds you.
So,
Josh.
Well, Act of Killing, for those who haven't seen it, is a documentary about... The genocide isn't quite accurate. Mass murder of
communists in inverted commas
in Indonesia in the 60s, basically killing mainly ethnic... Well, I guess, yeah, it was genocide in a sense. Mainly killing Chinese people in Indonesia or anyone they didn't like on the grounds of being a communist. The film, though, is not about...
It's not about the killings, it's about the killers.
And if you want to learn about the Indonesian killings, this isn't the film to see.
This film is basically a meditation. Well, it's kind of just an interrogation of the characters, kind of, that were kind of born out of both that situation and to a degree by cinema. And it's kind of a bit of a, you know, it's a very kind of meta look at the mindset of a killer and these men who 40 years later, because the reality of the situation is the regime that was around at the time are still in power. So yeah, these men are not only... you know, they've gotten away with their crimes. They're also heroes of the state. And the point is, Joshua Oppenheimer, who directed it, went to Indonesia to make, I think, just more like a humanist kind of advocacy film about the survivors.
A sort
and
of
stuff.
Individual, Invisible Children-esque doco. But, not that bad.
Not quite. But essentially, everyone was kind of scared to speak about it. And the only people willing to speak about the matter at all, really, were the perpetrators. So, essentially, the main focus of the film is on Anwar Kongo, who was kind of a ringleader and professional gangster. Because the thing is, they're all kind of... I suppose they're paramilitary leaders, but they're also all gangsters.
No, they're not. They're kind of like private contractors hired. They were called movie theater gangsters. And basically the government needed people to carry out these killings, so they hired gangsters.
And essentially, kind of a large thrust of the film is also going into how they were inspired to carry out the killings by and got a lot of their ideas for methods from... films that they'd seen and would come out of like a lot of films and then carry out killings, like even to the point where the act of watching a film kind of became associated for them with the killings, to the point where they'd come out of an Elvis film and walk across the street and just beat someone to death.
And it was and he did kill over 1,000 people during this time. And of course we haven't gotten to the main thrust of this film, which is that the premise is that Oppenheimer offers Kongo the opportunity to make a film detailing these killings.
They get to reenact everything. It's completely up to them. They direct.
Anwar has final cut of the film along with his friend.
Herman Kato.
Herman.
And Ari, who's... because that's also one of the other really interesting things about this is that the characters of the... the killers, like just as characters within the body of a story or within the body of the documentary, they all have very distinct, they're all very distinct characters and have very distinct viewpoints on the killings. And Anwar, it's interesting, as one of the main, kind of the principal perpetrator of it and kind of the one who had the power then and now, kind of has a lot more difficulty justifying it, whereas Ari is, like, completely relativistic about the whole thing, and he says, you know, we won, we're on the right side of history, therefore we get to say what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really interesting.
Which is surprisingly a sophisticated sort of intellectual justification.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
complete bullshit.
Oh,
it's
completely.
Bullshit.
But it's, you know, it's interesting that that's the defense this guy gives.
But it's so rounded and completely the opposite, and just, as a result, completely, in terms of the argument that they all make, completely complementary to the other mindsets and viewpoints going on in the body of the film.
Yeah, but
which is, I mean, you can see that this was shot over many years, and there's always something to an observational documentary like that, you know, that always gives a lot more of a rounded sense of the reality of the situation. And that's one of the things about this film which is so terrifying, is that that sense of real verite, well, not even verite, because it is a documentary, that sense of reality is balanced by this sense that you're watching a very dark satire.
You are, but also I think, like, it's... documentaries can only observe, usually, what the camera captures, whereas by giving Anwar this outlet in the sort of film within the film, you basically get to see straight into his mind, and it's a fucked up place to be. But I think what the film so accurately sort of diagnoses in Indonesia is it shows what happens when there is no culture of sort of culpability. This is what happens to it. Because, I mean, everyone realises... It's interesting. It's kind of the flip side to all these films we've been talking about, 12 Years a Slave and Wolf of Wall Street. Everyone knows they're wrong, but... because they're in a culture that doesn't allow them to take responsibility, they disappear into these bizarre solipsistic sort of wasteland of no morality. And I think that's what the act of killing exposes most so horrendously is that. And then, of course, the beautiful thing is Anwar, so minor spoiler for the end, and don't give away the very last scene, but Anwar, when watching the film, says, "Oh, Josh, I think I understand now. I think I understand what it was like to be one of these people." And Oppenheimer rightfully says, "No, you don't. You really don't, because you have that removed. You can, you know,
you like these people, like you
know they, you're acting."
Yeah, they knew they were going to die, and then that just that line where he says, "Have I sinned?" And that for me is one of the most powerful moments I've ever seen on screen.
And you see the struggle for Anwar isn't that he's feeling guilty, it's that he doesn't, and he's disturbed by that. And you see what's, I think, troubling him, and the question the whole film is guilt entirely based on context? You know, do we need someone to tell us we're wrong to come to terms with what we've done?
Yeah, I think that's a really kind of valid question. I suppose that's kind of the center of it. I mean, I think the entire idea of conscience and guilt is something that I've kind of always been fascinated by, and I've always kind of, I mean, in anything I've kind of really responded to or created has kind of been one of the central kind of ideas at the center of it. I think cinema is a really kind of good medium for that. I mean,
It's a film.
It's fascinating. Like that moment where he even if he doesn't come to terms with it, even if he doesn't completely have a hit of conscience or a hint of guilt, it's still a moment which is a completely new thought, which we're exactly. kind of thinking needs to be in his mind the whole time. And like I've seen so many fucking films that just manipulate and contrive these completely like useless revelations for a character. Like the three act structure just dictates that, you know, you start out a certain way, you have a status quo, and then you throw apples at your character throughout act two, and then in act three they've learned something. I've seen so many people learn so many fucking lessons, but none of them ever fucking mean anything. And this, like, in terms of like a character changing and developing, he goes back to you really see that he has this response.
Yeah, I really
to some
don't
degree.
Want to talk about the final scene, yeah. but I just, you know, that I think is kind of one of the most transcendent moments. But we were saying before.
I mean, I think we've, like, spoiled it quite.
Yeah, heavily. But I really don't want to, because I think, you know, the act of killing, you need to see it, and that experience can't be ruined. But I do want to keep that sort of sacred.
Yeah.
But we were saying before, you know, the act of killing, unlike so many films like Spring Breakers and Computer Chess and Wolf of Wall Street, you know, like we had something to add to these films to kind of say why. The act of killing is so intelligent and just speaks for itself that it's almost hard to really say much about it. You just have to see it. And that is it's why it's such a good place to end, because I think more than any film on this list, you need to see it.
Mm. I think, like, just there's so many fucking moments in this film which just, The thing about it is that I think the reason it feels so intense is that it kind of toes this line between absolute reality, which, I mean, it is, but also the complete unbelievability of everything that's going on. I think it's worth pointing out that the two executive producers of this film are Errol Morris and
Werner Herzog.
So, you know, you hear, like, either of them talk about documentary, and it was kind of the point you made earlier on Stories We Tell and talking about the documentary form, that, you know, there seems to be this mentality that documentary is where you get facts, and, you know, to kind of, like, I think the Werner Herzog attitude to it is the best I've ever heard. He said, like, if you want to know facts, then you go to the telephone directory. It is full of facts, but you will never find any revelation in it or
it's
nothing like that.
It's the aesthetic truth.
It is the aesthetic truth. But, you know, that's completely true. I mean, to be perfectly honest, though, for the record, I would listen to Werner Herzog reading the phone.
I know,
book.
Which would be a great experiment. But I think Werner Herzog is almost like, this is the film he wish he made. you know, this is almost like beating Werner Herzog at his own game.
Yeah.
I think the act of killing will kind of be one.
I think absolutely. Like, I must admit, like, anything that I've kind of created in the time since then has been influenced by it. And the quest, I mean, you know, it kind of like, it just sits in that really odd territory. Like, there are a couple of moments where they're actually acting out things in the movie that they're making, and they're so like influenced by gangster and noir films, and you're just looking at that, kind of looking at that same thing you've been looking at for years and years, but you're also looking at the fact that they're realizing that it's affected them, and it's the aesthetic that's affected them. So I think it's interesting that in the context of all this, like, kind of particularly on 12 Years a Slave, where we're talking about aesthetic having distancing you from it, like, no, you're an absolute moron if you think that aesthetic has no impact on a person. Like,
exactly.
Aesthetic is the thing that worms its way into you without you realizing. Like, you need to be aware of what it is. You need to be kind of aware of the ways in which you're being manipulated so that you can liberate your response and become, you know, in a time of complete and total visual manipulation, to become, you know, able to be aware of the ways in which you're being directed and conditioned. Like,
it's interesting. It's
and
interesting
I think
how
this film really kind of like hits on that. There are a couple of really intense moments like that that just kind of make you really, really kind of scared of the situation in which you live and your response to it, and kind of like kind of motivate. I mean, personally, it just motivates you to kind of be very aware of what it is you're seeing, very aware of what you allow to kind of become a part of you.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I also think it's interesting that the three films we chose are all about kind of it's dealing with sort of what we accept. I think 12 Years a Slave, Wolf of Wall Street, and Act of Killing are all about these various morally reprehensible cultures that we kind of have to ignore, and the ways, you know, so on a meta level, 12 Years a Slave is confronting a very present sort of American failure to deal with slavery and its repercussions, and sort of the Gone with the Wind style Southern nostalgia that's categorized a lot of the way that that history is depicted. You've had Wolf of Wall Street, which kind of confronts head on how modern American capitalism encourages this behavior and how these people never get punished. And then, of course, Act of Killing, which, even though it's about this Indonesian conflict, is so much just about the very notion of how we deal with atrocities and how we kind of process them. And
both in terms of how culturally and societally we deal with it, and also on a personal level.
Yes, but completely, and how they feed into each other. So I think, it's...
I mean,
so this was unanimous. Interestingly also, and this was after we made our choice for number one, we agreed with Sight and Sound, which was interesting.
I mean, it is the film, like there is no film like this this year. I mean,
no, it's the film of the year, I think, unquestionably, and I think once you see it...
I think it's that good that it should win Best Documentary without question at the Oscars, like...
Yeah, and I think it kind of might be one of those things where the
Academy... Act of Killing, Joshua Oppenheimer, yeah.
This is
Joshua Joshua Oppenheimer's first nomination and win. Joshua learned to speak Indonesian during the speech.
Just a few days ago, Oppenheimer won the BAFTA, and
he
took the opportunity to basically attack the US and the UK for their culpability. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Well, let's segue that into...
It's probably going to be 20 Feet from Stardom, which is a fucking joke. I mean, it's fine, but it's just another good old, like, dinky, like, yeah.
I don't know. I think they kind of, they've given that to Sugar Man. And, you know, don't forget that the Academy did give it to Fahrenheit 9/11, which at the time was a much more confronting documentary.
Yeah, but they were obviously, like, there was, like, well, they did boo him off stage.
Yeah, exactly. No, I ain't saying that it's going to be pretty.
I think that's like more a reason why they would go for something safe, because like after a dude like that gets up after making a documentary about, you know, we need to be culpable, and then he gets up and says, "Excuse me, I still believe that." They're like, "Boo, get off."
Oh yeah, I know. Also, that film happened to be owned by the Weinsteins. So, I mean, let's take the segue. I think we kind of are limited in what we can talk about Act of Killing.
We've talked about a fair bit. We're kind of in a weird middle ground where, like, if you have seen it, then you just, like, talk about more.
You'll know. You'll understand when you see the film. So let's talk about, as we move on, let's talk about the Oscars.
I just want to, like, go and watch Act of Killing now, again.
I don't know if I can watch it for a while. It's an extremely confronting film.
Yeah. Also, just one other point. On, their meaning for the word gangster is free.
Yeah.
And, I mean, of course, the way that, kind of, you know, throughout the film, like, any kind of use of the word free is then kind of linked to that mindset that free means murder. And it's really unsettling. I mean,
well, it's a fascinating contrast to Jordan Belfort. It's these people sort of using freedom in the name of sort of this excuse to commit atrocities. You know, it's freedom. It's the free market. It's the freedmen. It's the, you know. Yeah. And then that's very interesting to compare to Wolf of Wall Street.
God.
Anyway, so go see Act of Killing. I think it's online. You can... the DVD's out with both cuts of the film.
We don't want to encourage illegal activities, are we?
No, it's actually streaming legally online.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Also, the directors... I wouldn't mind getting the DVD because there's a lot of bonus content that I think probably would be very much worth watching. Mm. Like a lot of those good documentaries. Often the bonus features are just as interesting as the film itself. But let's move on to something a bit more frivolous. The
Well, that's it. Well, we've finished the countdown. There we go. That's our top ten. Our top ten. I suppose we ought really to recap. So number 10, we had Computer Chess.
Yes.
Number 9, Stories We Tell. Number 8, Filth. Number 7, Upstream Color. 6, The Great Beauty. 5, Spring Breakers and Her. 3, 12 Years a Slave. 2, Wolf of Wall Street. And 1, Act of Killing.
There you go.
That was the cavies, ladies and gentlemen.
That was the cavies. Thank you for listening.
Now we have a bit of fun and talk about our picks for 2014, what we're looking forward to.
No. The Academy Awards are in a week.
Before we get to the predictive cavies for next year, we'll just talk about why the Oscars are going to suck, are we?
Well, I mean, this is the thing, you know, as we said, the Oscars are important, so whether or not you agree with them, there is something to be...
They do matter, and the thing is, they always get really close to getting it right.
Yeah. And this is the thing that I've hated about the Oscars lately, is it's like they'll nominate films like Zero Dark Thirty and Amour and Django Unchained, all these interesting films, and then fucking give it to Argo. You know, so they're always on the cusp of getting it right. I would still disagree
with that because every year there's always some incredible films that get completely left out altogether.
Sure, but I think like they more or less get, in the nominations, you often get close to the cream of the crop of the American films.
And also, just to mention, without like the prestige that is now attached to Tarantino, I don't think his films would... They're not exactly Academy films a lot of the time. Maybe for best screenplay because they are so incredibly overwritten. But Oscar... fuck Tarantino. I mean, anyway, Oscar lamentations. Well, essentially, I was a bit bothered to see... I wanted Joaquin to get a bit of a nod.
Did he not even get nominated for
Best Actor, which is fucking bullshit.
Particularly after The Master.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is ridiculous.
Oh, did you see at the BAFTAs, this was interesting. It was, I suppose, I don't know if it was a turn up or not, but Barkhad Abdi won Best Supporting Actor for Captain Phillips.
Interesting.
Which is very interesting, which kind of, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a cat amongst the pigeons for the Oscar predictions, but it does kind of spice things up. I mean, it's one of those things where you hope he doesn't, because then it'd mean like he did, because he's a very unique type and there aren't going to be a whole lot of roles for him. So we kind of like do a film, win an Oscar, and then kind of, you know, recede and not really do a whole lot. But, you know, and because then everyone else is like, oh, you won your Oscar, what are you doing next?
Yeah, yeah. Good point, actually. But everyone knows our pick for... Supporting Actor.
Best Supporting Actor. Jonah, I am really pissed off that Jared Leto is going to win an Oscar for this. I mean, an Oscar for that performance. Because it's just one of those things where it's just a time when that kind of role, it's that character more than the performance that is going to win that award. And it just kind of pisses me off because Jonah Hill is so, so good in Wolf of Wall Street. And the complete 180 that his career has done in the space of 2 or 3 years is remarkably impressive, has capped off in a genuinely brilliant performance that warrants that award.
Yeah, but it's also interesting that everyone's counting out Michael Fassbender, who I thought gave an amazing performance. And I'm surprised, and you know, he in one of the front runner films, I'm surprised that he's not being talked about more seriously. The thing is, though, they give it to The Hideous Plantation, and I think the Academy really has to give it to Lupita Nyong'o for 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
And I think that's very plausible, and I'm glad, because that is such a spectacular role. Yeah,
if Jennifer Lawrence fucking wins... No, I swear to God, if Jennifer Lawrence wins for Best Supporting Actress, like, I like Jennifer Lawrence. I think she's good. If there was anything in American Hustle, just about everyone else, that was the thing I liked. Because she has a presence, but the reality is she is just Jennifer Lawrence. Like, she's not necessarily playing a character that is that. Like, her accent slips up a fair bit. Like, she's not necessarily playing a character all that different from the kind of feisty character she played in Silver Linings Playbook, which was not all that brilliant, didn't deserve a Best Actress award. Like, the reality is, if she wins Best Supporting Actress, she's got two Oscars in 2 years.
I know.
Like, she is two-time Academy Award winner at 23. If you read that on paper, you have to be fucking phenomenal. Like, not only just, like, a reasonably likable personality, like, and reasonable presence on
she's
screen.
She's a good actress.
She is, but, like, she's not that good. She's not two-time Academy Award winner at 23.
She should be.
That's a fucking joke. Particularly when Lupita Nyong'o is so fucking good in 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah, I know. I kind of
like Jennifer Lawrence to stick around, and I feel like if she wins two Academy Awards now, you're just going to be like, fuck off.
Well, yeah, I mean, you hope she kind of becomes like a Meryl Streep or something.
You'd hope so.
Yeah. It's plausible, but then again, she could go the way of so many great actresses like Naomi Watts, or... But we don't talk about Naomi Watts anymore. You're dead to me, boy. Yeah. You're more dead to me than you're dead, boy.
Best Actor is a really interesting race. It is, actually.
Not really. It's McConaughey.
I know it is, but, like, I really feel like DiCaprio and Ejiofor both... I mean...
No, I don't think Ejiofor deserves it. Good performance, very strong, great film.
Anybody who has the restraint to, like, use Buster Keaton as a principal reference for a performance deserves, like, any major acting award, as far as I'm concerned.
I know it was a strong performance, but it was, like, sort of... Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it had the same quality that... the two other great performances of the years did. And I don't think it was as strong in the same way that Fassbender and Nyong'o were. It was very good, but I feel like that would kind of be... And look, if he gets it, good for him. Like, I'm not going to be crying. Mm. But I think that would sort of be an award for the film and not necessarily for the performance.
I suppose so, yeah.
I think that was largely McQueen's doing sort of what he got out. And, you know... he had to underplay it a lot for that film, which is fine. But when you have to underplay to make a movie good, that doesn't mean you've done the best performance. It just means you've done your job right. There is a difference.
Yeah.
Best Actress, I mean, it's interesting to see if Cate Blanchett does get the award, considering the recent Woody Allen controversy. There's no one really. I mean, what, do we give it to Judi Dench?
I mean, Meryl could win it again, but then that's just ridiculous.
No, I mean... Amy Adams
is really good, but it is a supporting role. Like,
it's still the front runner, though. I just Sandra Bullock can't get it. Surely
she couldn't. No.
Surely that's off limits. I mean, she's a not good actress to begin with. She's definitely not good in Gravity.
Hey, she's great
in Gravity.
She's like it's not a role that you know you. It's not really an award-winning role. It's kind of just, you know, you kind of just let the visual spectacle happen around you. And you
yeah, exactly. But, like, I mean, you know, just that had nothing... You could have put anyone in that role and it would have had the same effect.
Yeah, sure. But, like, well, I'm not saying it was bad.
No, it wasn't bad, but it sure as hell... I mean, that's just a case of the Academy once again sort of going, well, we liked Gravity, so, I mean, surely she must be up for a best.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Now, Best Director's really interesting.
If David O. Russell wins...
It's fucking plausible. Actually, it's like, really plausible.
That's a fucking joke.
It's really...
There's always a joke every year, and I really hope that's not the one. Particularly because, like, if you have David O. Russell winning the same year that Martin Scorsese delivers a masterpiece...
And Steve McQueen and Alfonso Cuarón.
And Alfonso Cuarón. I think Alfonso Cuarón will win, to be perfectly honest.
Well, no, see, that was my initial thought. Okay, so it's going to be 12... It's going to be like a Life of Pi sort of situation, where the sort of most visual splendor weak screenplay award goes to the director, which I think is good. I think that's why those awards... are separate, and
yeah.
I hope Cuarón gets it. Also, I think McQueen very much deserves it. Obviously, I think Scorsese really should win that one.
Yeah.
So I think they couldn't make it so that Alfonso sort of takes Ang Lee's award, but...
I think it depends on the screenplay thing, because if Russell wins for screenplay, then he's not going to win for director.
That's very true.
But the thing is, I think Spike Jonze is going to win for her.
Very interesting.
Maybe. Because, I mean, the reality is, I mean, obviously we're pointing out, like, the Academy is generally 70-year-old white dudes.
No, it's diversified. They've actually done, like, this year is going to be a huge break.
Oh, wow.
In terms of demographics, which is why the picks are slightly better.
Okay.
Arguably, it's just a better... prestige. Well, but you have to remember that, I mean, this year, just so many films that would have been shoo-ins got rejected. I mean, The Butler, Diana, all these cookie cutter Oscar bait films, they just got rejected out of hand. Saving Mr. Banks. All these films that were meant to appeal to these 70-year-old white men were rejected by the voting. So I think it's going to be really interesting. I think a lot of the assumptions we're making about the Oscars, we have to kind of revise. But if they give it to David O. Russell, then fuck off.
I'm still very cynical because it is still the Oscars.
It's like, still the Oscars. I'm still cynical.
It still has the smell of mothballs. Like, that's the reality. Like,
I think, sadly, the Academy love David O. Russell. That's a fact. But they probably have enough integrity to recognise that American Hustle is... obviously not the best film of the year, and there's no way it can lose to 12 Years, which I now think is poised to definitely win over Gravity.
I hope so. I hope...
Regardless, I don't think they can make an argument that it's better than those two films. However, their love of David O. Russell is so strong...
I think it's
then I think they'll try and make up for that in director.
They definitely have flavours, don't they? Because, I mean, a little while ago it was the Coen brothers and that was, you know, a lot more justified. But, like, A Serious Man got nominated for Best Picture and I think Inside Llewyn Davis is a lot better, but it's kind of like the hangover after, like... Because, I mean, they won with No Country.
Mm.
Then, like, almost, you know, it's just like this kind of... you know, just required that they get nominated then for A Serious Man. Like, I think probably barely anyone even saw it or got it or enjoyed it. But then after that, because they didn't particularly like A Serious Man, then Inside Llewyn Davis doesn't really get a look in.
Which is
cool, because I hope that happens with O. Russell at some point, which could be, you know...
But that wouldn't that mean he has to win it? Because people like... The Academy clearly liked American Hustle. Sad, but true.
It's just a romp. You might as well give it to grown-ups,
I mean, yeah, look.
I mean, it is, like, it does have things going for it, like, you know, it's nice to, it's a disco ball. It is a disco ball.
But it's empty on the inside. But we bought the kid a cake, because cakes have layers. Well, actually, we were watching the American Hustle trailer, and it starts with a line, you know.
People come from all over the world to see this. Like, yeah, it's amazing, like. It's a fake. Well, it's not a fake. This is impossible. Like, people come from all over the world to see this, and the forger was so good, they think it's the original. Who's the real artist? The painter or the forger?
Which sums up David O. Russell, because, you know, he's a fake artist.
He's the forger, and Scorsese is the original.
Is the original. And just the film in general.
So basically, if he wins, then it just kind of points out the fact that the Academy goes for forgeries over originals.
Which maybe justifies American... Maybe American Hustle is a subtle... Maybe it's sort just of a really subtle meta critique.
Like, he's just like, look at me, I can't actually direct.
Yeah, I doubt it somehow. The other thing I'm interested in is the best foreign language film. Will it be Grand Beauty or will it be The Hunt?
I think it'd be The Great Beauty. The Great Beauty, by the way, as well, not The Grand Beauty.
Did I say Grand? It's because I get confused between... Yeah, I get confused between the titles.
It's got to be.
I think The Hunt has a strong... For one thing, it has Mads Mikkelsen, which I should have mentioned for best performance because he is extraordinary in it. So Mads Mikkelsen has a lot of cachet in The Americans for Hannibal and for those various genre roles he does. I wouldn't be surprised if that beats it over Great Beauty, but I hope the Great Beauty gets it.
One thing that I'm definitely annoyed about is that Please, Mr. Kennedy wasn't nominated for Best Original Song.
Yes, and of course, Best Original Song lost a nomination because of that bizarre, like, ultra...
Like, be careful before you say that, like, the Academy's cleaned up its act, because they obviously just put someone in because they were just like, oh, yeah, somebody sent out an email, yeah, I'll put that in.
I know,
like, that's how it happened, and, like, apparently this is really, really, really bad, like... You know, really conservative propaganda film, which is just really funny.
Yeah.
Which is just brilliant. But best documentary has to be The Act of Killing. If it's 20 Feet from Stardom, I'm going to be a bit pissed off.
Well, look, I mean...
Because I saw it and it was just average. I mean, it was great, but it was average.
I mean, see, the thing is, the connecting thing about these docos isn't... See, you think it won't win because of films like, you know, Searching for Sugar Man... See, there's no trend with documentary. The award for best documentary always goes to the one film each year that anyone's actually heard of, which is The Act of Killing. It'll just win on that alone. People will be like, yeah, I've heard Act of Killing's good, or I saw The Act of Killing. That's the only film anyone's going to fucking see.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, well, I
but at the same time, I don't really care, because it's still Act of Killing.
Exactly, and it's kind of won. But where did it premiere?
I don't know.
Was it Cannes?
I don't know. But also, Best Original Score, kind of hope, goes to Her, because of, obviously...
Yes.
For Will Butler, was it?
It was Will Butler and Owen Pallett. Also, they were nominated for Song, for the Moon Song that she sings.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
But I think...
That's good. I hope they win for that.
Yeah, they won't. It'll be fucking frozen.
It was Karen O, wasn't it? That was Karen
O. Yeah, it was Karen O. That's cool. It's like Jones' wife. But, sorry.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Sadly, I think it's gonna probably go to Disney and Frozen.
Bastards.
But still, Karen O is gonna be performing at the Oscars, so that's worth seeing.
Not really. It's an Oscars song performance. That's when you go to the loo.
But it's Karen O.
I know, but it's still at the Oscars, so yeah, it'll be like really bad mix.
Yeah, like really, the Adele travesty last year.
They'll have like some terrible like swooping camera, like zooming around, and then she'll like be like, "Well, the camera's in my face, so I suppose I ought to sing into it," and then like sing to the 2,000 to 5,000 people sitting down, looking at me, going, "Yeah, yeah." Apparently, she's in a band called the Yeah Yeah Yeah. You're just like,
"Oh, now I'm just depressed."
Sorry.
Anyway, let's talk about something fun. Let's move on to our what we're looking forward to in 2014, which initially was this tiny list of about 3 films. And then we kind of went, no, let's actually have a look what's coming out.
And
a
we
lot
got
of stuff.
So excited.
A lot of stuff.
I'm
There's
really
a lot of
excited.
Fucking
There's
awesome
a lot of
stuff
really
coming
dope
out.
Stuff
Get
coming
excited.
Out this year. All right, so let's start. I'm going to start with Inherent Vice because... I haven't read it. I'm not quite the Pynchon cat that Sorrow is, but I obviously it's PTA and we're keen. And the shots from it, like shots from set, make me so excited. There is a shot which is 470 foot of dolly track. I am so excited for that. That just makes me just fucking smile. So yeah, what's your...
Well, I mean, a film that, you know, kind of in the same way, I don't know what to compare it to, but, well, no, okay, first I want to start with the film that's coming out that I'm most excited for, which is Nymphomaniac.
Mm.
Now, I don't like Lars von Trier's, I don't give a shit about Lars von Trier's, but this is the film Lars von Trier was always meant to make, okay? It's a 5-hour sex epic. I'm sorry, like, it's going to be amazing. It could be awful, but it will be amazing in that way. But I've heard very good things about it. It looks really interesting.
I see all the trailers just make me so excited. Like, the one where Shia LaBeouf is just walking around an office saying, "Good job, Liz." Like,
I know.
English accent, like, it's the only sentence that he's, like, learnt how to speak. And he's like, "Look at me doing an English
accent." And the presence of Shia LaBeouf in that film just kind of elevates it for me, you know?
Like, this little kid wandering around, like, thinking he's an artist. Like, I kind of... I'm interested to see how the Shia LaBeouf plays out. Also, is it LaBeef or LaBeouf or LaBeouf or how do you say it?
I don't know. He's not famous.
Oh.
Anyway, so
next, I'll just quickly go on to Grand Budapest. I mean, this is the thing.
Not seeing
we
it.
We both hate
fuck it.
Wes Anderson. I like Royal Tenenbaums. I like Darjeeling Limited, but apart from that, I find him quite insufferable. Which is odd because like they're not even necessarily all that different, but they're the only two that have some kind of point of difference from the other ones, which makes them, you know, unique and interesting. Grand Budapest actually looks like it's finally actually firing on all cylinders, because the 4:3 actually looks like it will complement his composition a lot more than the widescreen has.
It was 4:3, but that makes sense how it is.
Just Ralph Fiennes is the perfect actor for that kind of hammy, like, oh, la-di-da. But he actually always has some degree of humanity and humor in everything he does. I really like Ralph Fiennes, so I'm excited to see that, because I think he's right for not only the role, but for a Wes Anderson character. I'm interested in seeing this cast, like, which extends to Harvey Keitel and Saoirse Ronan and... Adrian Brody and Willem Dafoe and just all these guys. I'm really excited for that. I just think it's going to be his best, and it looks very. I also love Fantastic Mr. Fox. I should mention it. Kind of like seems like Fantastic Mr. Fox in Romania, which just, you know, kind of like strikes me as fun.
It just looks like.
Oh wait, no, Budapest. Shit, where's Budapest? I'm very bad at geography.
It just looks like every other fucking Wes Anderson film.
Mm.
And every time they say, no, this one's going to be different, it's just...
Bulgaria?
No, hungry.
Hungry. Shit.
Look, you know how I feel about Wes Anderson. I'm not going to see that one. A few films that we've... First of all, there's a new Peter Bogdanovich film.
Yeah.
Called Squirrels to the Nuts.
Produced by...
Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach,
which is very starring Owen Wilson.
Yeah,
which is like,
it's a weird one. Good chance it's going to be awful, but you know, like, it's kind of the awful film that I'll give a shot to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's either going to be the surprise success or the biggest disappointment. It could go either way because I don't know.
I don't know. It couldn't really be a biggest disappointment unless it's like really bad. Boyhood looks
Boyhood,
really
which
good.
Boyhood, which recently won Linklater. Sundance, I believe.
Berlin? It was just a Berlin.
It won Berlin.
Something at Berlin. But
was it Sundance, though?
But, I'm really excited to see that, because it is a time-spanning Richard Linklater opus again.
And you don't have to watch three of them.
Exactly. It's just in one film. So, you know, span. I mean, it's an idea that... I think it's very interesting, because you've kind of got a lot of documentaries that kind of follow people for extended periods of time. Not so many feature films that do that. So
yeah.
I think it'll be a really, really...
Although, to be fair, Truffaut kind of did it.
Yeah, but they're all... But, like, none of them are as good as 400 Blows.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And kind of the point of the end of the 400 Blows is the uncertainty and the ambiguity of it. So to kind of actually concretely address that in the ensuing four films kind of defeats the purpose.
Yeah, and I think that's just kind of one of those films we're going to have to see just to sort of... I feel like no matter how well it works or it doesn't work, it will sort of be something to marvel at, the nature of the project. I'm going to see... There are a few films that I just kind of... I've got to see Gone Girl, because I'll always see what David Finch does. I think the last film was Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, wasn't it?
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
I thought that was a very weak film for him. Very cookie cutter when he usually does really interesting things. Interestingly, this is another crime thriller adaptation. I think he's a very strong director. And no matter how weak the script is, like in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, he will always be technically very strong. In a similar category, going to see Interstellar because I think Nolan's a very confident director.
And the reconnaissance.
It's another thing.
Hey, I just realised Life Aquatic was awesome. Fuck you. Wes Anderson's great. Actually, yeah, that's more good films than shit. There you go.
It's the same film.
But it's Bill Murray being awesome. So
no, fuck no, off. I'm sick of the cult of Bill Murray.
No, Bill
I'm
Murray.
Oh, no.
Get fucked. No. No,
fuck it.
No, no. You're fucked.
Well, no. Life Aquatic is a tedious piece.
No, it isn't.
It's just the Royal Tenenbaums under the sea.
He wears blue and a red beanie.
This is precisely... What have you been drinking while we... Like, this is Wes Anderson. He wears blue, yeah.
No, but it's got the Spanish guy. Oh, it's the Portuguese guy playing the...
I know,
playing
exactly. Who cares? Oh, superficial shit.
But it's Bill Murray.
So there's also Interstellar, and then there's the flip side of that, Transcendence, which is Wally Pfeiffer's director.
Wally Pfister. Anyway, I'm really excited about that. The trailer looks fucking brilliant, and
maybe he'll sort of go back and repeat the career of Christopher Nolan, you know, like Memento, which was actually a really good film, and then just go more.
Did he shoot Interstellar? I don't think so. I mean, I suppose he wouldn't. But that
no, he didn't. It's the first time since
Following.
No,
he did shoot. He did shoot Memento.
Oh, okay. Well, so yeah, it's the first film.
Actually, wait, no, he didn't. Shut up. I'm going to stop talking. I'm going to talk about the next film I'm excited for, Birdman, which is Alejandro González Iñárritu of Amores Perros, 21 Grams, Babel, and Beautiful Fame, doing apparently a dark comedy about Michael Keaton trying to... who was once an action hero.
Okay.
Like, trying to get a Broadway play up on stage. And it's got, like, Emma Stone and Julianne Moore and a bunch of other really kind of odd kind of people to turn up in an Alejandro González Iñárritu dark comedy.
See, I've, confession, never actually seen an Iñárritu film.
Really?
No.
Well, you should, because they're good.
Yeah, I 21 well, they, Grams they, and Babel are...
They do leave a lot to be desired.
I've heard Amores very Perros mixed is really good. About
21
Babel.
Grams is really good. Babel's... Yeah, it's
I good. Feel like Code Unknown will ruin it for me, sort of retroactively.
Yeah, no.
There's a... Well, I mean... The film that we just found out about, like, sort of 10 minutes before this podcast, is so a new Wim Wenders project.
3D.
It's called Everything Will Be Fine. It's Wim Wenders. It's in 3D. It stars James Franco, Charlotte Gainsbourg, and Sarah Polley.
Oh, my God.
It follows Franco dealing with 12 years of tragedy after he kills a child. And it's
he's a writer, isn't he? He's a writer who, yes. Like, for 12 years just, like, follows the impact that his, like... after he accidentally kills a child, he follows his impact for 12 years. Like,
it's...
In 3D. Whoa.
I know.
And knowing Wim Wenders, it's probably going to be this really weird road movie as well, where he just drives, like... Imagine, like, a 3D road movie. It's going to be really, really funny.
I think that's kind of my number two pick for most anticipated, but my number one... for the year is, which may actually not get released next year, it's probably going to be delayed till 2015 unless the Weinsteins go for Academy Award season, and that is Carol, which is the upcoming film by Todd Haynes. I said Todd Haynes.
No, I know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I'm
Todd saying. Haynes, I think, is one of the best American directors alive, and... He's never done a false note, and I don't mean as in he doesn't have a bad film. He doesn't have a bad scene. All his films are perfect. It looks like he's kind of going, you know, back to sort of the period drama that he's
and
done.
I mean, if there's anyone who can and who should do, like, period, it's Haynes.
Yes,
nails it.
Which he did in Mildred Pierce and Far From Heaven. It's adapted from a Patricia Highsmith book, who did the Ripley novels. It stars Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett. I think it's just...
It was going to be Mia Wasikowska for a little while, which would have been funny, because she's kind of been touted as the upcoming Cate Blanchett, but...
Well, Rooney
out.
Mara's kind of got cred.
I mean, either way, I'm going to see it. I'm going to see it with great interest. Speaking, like, vaguely on Australia, The Rover, which is David Michaud's follow-up to Animal Kingdom, is coming out 2014. That's Robert Pattinson and Guy Pearce and Susan Pryor.
Okay.
I think.
I'll see that one.
Sure. Apparently it's great.
people who've seen it reckon it's great.
Oh, that's a good one. I'm definitely going to be seeing Midnight Special because I've Jeff yet Nichols. To see a Jeff Nichols film and I feel really bad. So I think I'm going to do a Jeff Nichols marathon and then go see Midnight Special.
Mm-hmm.
A film that looks amazing is A Most Wanted Man. It's Anton Corbijn doing...
Who did Control.
Who did Control and a whole lot of music videos. Doing a John Le Carré novel. Yeah, yeah. Starring Philip Seymour Hoffman. I had no idea this performance existed. So, you know, rest assured, there is still a Philip Seymour Hoffman performance out there that we are yet to see. And with that talent, you know,
hopefully
it I think it will be very good. And when I heard that, I was like, of course Corbijn's doing Le Carré, he's perfect for it.
Yeah. I'm also really excited for Only Lovers Left Alive, which is Jim Jarmusch with Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston playing vampires and Mia Wasikowska playing a vampire.
Oh yeah, I've heard of this one, yeah.
I think that's very soon, isn't it? Yeah. If anyone's gonna do vampires well, it's gonna be Jarmusch. I mean, if anybody's going to do anything interesting and just like chuck something out there, it's going to be Jarmusch. I'm really excited for that one.
I'm also really excited for Calvary, which is the new Martin McDonagh film.
John Michael McDonagh, who's his brother, who did
It's Martin, isn't it?
No, it's John. It's John Michael. I'm pretty sure.
Is it Mal? No, it's. Hang on.
I'm pretty sure it's John Michael McDonagh.
Isn't it Martin and Michael?
John Michael.
Oh.
Anyway, I'm excited for that one as well. So,
yeah, it's Brendan Gleeson. It's The Guard was a really strong film, but more importantly, it is tackling child abuse in this really interesting way. So I think didn't you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, no, it's apparently a really sort of smart but not too angry approach to the subject, and it just sounds very well done and. Could be sort of, he could surpass Malcolm. You're right, Martin. John Michael.
Yeah, Martin. It's John Michael and Martin. I'm intrigued, not necessarily excited, but Paul Dano is playing Brian Wilson in Love and Mercy. And I mean, I just like found that out on the pure basis of going like, well, Paul Dano really doesn't seem to get all that much work except in really good period films. Like, because I mean, obviously, you know, like he's distinct presence in There Will Be Blood and in 12 Years a Slave. And he has a face that just suits a period feel. So it's interesting. I mean, it is period, but
I can really see him as Brian Wilson. But it gets so much better. You've left out the best bit. He plays the young Brian Wilson, and then John Cusack plays the old Brian Wilson.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that sounds wacky.
Whoa. Who's directing that?
It's Bill Pollard, who did...
Bugger All, by the look of it. Anyway.
He's a film...
He's a producer. Oh, yeah, he produced 12 Years a Slave.
And Tree of Life.
Oh, Christ. That's going to be interesting. Is that going to be going for Oscars? That feels like flop Oscar. That feels like didn't get nominated for anything Oscar. Like,
yeah, the bait that they didn't take,
like
maybe.
The 10-time Oscar producer, never winner. Like,
yeah.
You know.
Maybe.
I'm interested. I'm curious to see how it goes. It just seems a bit calculated. As if any venture in Hollywood isn't.
But I'm also really excited for Veronica Mars. Which is a TV show I love.
Yeah, Maps to the Stars, which is
David Cronenberg,
which is like his indictment. I'm guessing it's going to be an indictment of sorts on celebrity culture.
So it's his Bling Ring Spring Breakers sort of 2013
and
film.
And it's interesting because Antiviral, which was his son's film, was about I suppose just this kind of it was kind of like a dystopian society where people can get the diseases that their and illnesses that their favorite stars are afflicted by. And I mean it was kind of a return to that kind of body horror that like David Cronenberg was kind of doing in the 80s, but by Brandon Cronenberg and was Caleb Landry Jones. It was fucking awesome. But this would be interesting.
The other film that I'm extremely excited for, even though there's a strong chance it's going to be awful, is Terrence Malick's upcoming film, which at the moment has the title Untitled 2014 Terrence Malick Project. It stars Christian Bale and Kate Blanchett, I believe.
Yep.
It was shot in the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. So basically, when you think about it, Terrence Malick has made an alternative Nashville. I hope so.
What probably happened
is he just had his actors walk around South by Southwest, shot a bunch of filming, and he's going to fucking assemble it in the editing
room.
And
then put a voiceover.
And then put a voiceover. Put some psalms over it. So it could be... don't get too excited, because that film could be awful. But there's a chance it's going to be amazing.
Did you like Tree of Life?
I had issues with it, which I liked it. It should have been better.
I'd like to see a story like Tree of Life told the way Tree of Life is in a really chaotic environment like South by Southwest. Presumably.
That's true.
See, that's the thing. It could kind of be that kind of the inverse of a Scorsese thing, where it's kind of this really low thing, kind of told in this really operatic way, kind of this kind of really operatic thing, kind of told in this floaty, you know, transcendent, interesting way.
I mean, I thought, you know, The Tree of Life, it's just on a technical level, it's pretty amazing. Yeah. But it...
also shot by Emmanuel Lubezki, who shot this is shot by Emmanuel Lubezki, who shot Tree of Life and Gravity and Children of Men.
Oh, interesting.
Like, very comfortable playing two best cinematographer in the world.
I mean, Malick failed to... I think he didn't finish the film, essentially, in that I was very annoyed by the whole Sean Penn aspect of that film.
Mm.
And I feel like Malick... I don't know. I feel like his sort of auteur, wishy-washy sort of, I just follow my nose. Okay, it's starting to come back to bite him. I haven't seen... I love Badlands, obviously.
Apparently it's two intersecting love triangles. I remember that.
Well, look...
Not just a love triangle. Two intersecting love triangles. Like, what even is that? That's going to be hilarious.
I'm keeping it in mind. And we really... Actually,
I'm excited. I'm less cynical about it than you. I think it's going to be really good.
I hope it's really good. I just don't want to get too excited. And actually, we should, you know, retroactively, I'd like to give an honorary regret not seeing it award to The Wonder. Because you should...
No. That one kind of felt, like, really strong together. This one, like, feels like they waited and this was the one he wanted to do. Because he got a lot... Like, they had to wait for a while to get everyone they wanted. Who'd they get? They got Christian Bale, Natalie Portman, Ryan Gosling, Michael Fassbender... Kate Blanchett, Rooney Mara.
Christian Bale, isn't it?
Yeah, Christian Bale. That's what I said.
No, you just said Kate Blanchett twice.
Oh, right.
Okay, well, look, I hope it's good. I want it to be good.
And Benicio del Toro.
That does sound good. Yeah. Although, to The Wonder, I wanted to see, solely on the basis that it's the first contemporary Malick film.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Nothing's been as good as Badlands.
But, no. Yeah. I haven't seen Days of Heaven.
Yeah, it's not as good as Badlands.
I might go watch Days of Heaven.
There's so many films to watch. Yeah. Isn't that a great sentence? There are so many films to watch.
Well, I'd like to end with my cause for this year, which I want to encourage everyone to go. And my passion that I want to encourage is I want everyone to go see old films at the cinema.
Mm.
This isn't Cinematech, an intellectual property thing. You know, everyone's going, go see, support films. It's not just about supporting the industry. It's supporting actual cinemas and going to see old films in the environment that they were meant to be seen in, because you often get a whole nother level of appreciation to it.
It's difficult in Sydney, though.
It is, exactly. But if you go to see it, it's spreading. You know, Dendy and Palace, every cinema chain... independent cinema chain has its own program. So you can have a look at, if you're in Sydney, have a look at Norton Street's Vintage Electro on Norton Season. Some good films there, a lot of new Hollywood stuff, which, you know, very strong. Raging Bull, Godfather, a bit of classic Hollywood stuff.
Yeah, that is exciting.
Dendy, Newtown, their autumn.
We've got Blue program. Velvet, Mulholland Drive,
some Lynch, Apocalypse Now, both Kill Bills, One Floor Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and then Cinematech at the Chevelle next Monday are doing Ugetsu Monogatari, classic Japanese ghost story. And I just recently watched Under Capricorn, a sort of lost Hitchcock film, and this period melodrama, which uses a lot of context.
Yeah, I saw a season of Orson Welles films at Chevelle. Chevelle Cinematheque's really
Chevelle Cinematheque is very good, and you should support it, particularly because the Chevelle was almost closed down,
and we
lost almost our only dedicated Cinematheque program.
Yeah.
Furthermore, I'd like to point out that the Chevelle uses actual film.
Yeah. Nothing's quite as good as the Astor, though. The Astor in Melbourne, like, is an amazing cinema dedicated exclusively to...
Yes, and of course, there's also the Orpheum, which is very hard for us to get to, but if you live close to it, you should go to it.
Yeah.
Anyway...
I think we might be spouting bullshit by now.
Well, I...
I'd like to say my cause, which is to watch... what equates to a film a day. So 365 films this year, and finish Mad Men, and finish Sopranos, and rewatch The Wire, and get through, I think it's The Shield?
Yeah.
So I still get through all that.
Yes, and go see plays as well.
Yeah. And read books.
And read books and live and love and okay.
And
we should
drink
probably go
a lot of beer.
Yeah.
I'll be able to do that.
Well, that was the very existential at the end of Cavaliers Do Cinema.
That got sensible.
Cavaliers Do Cinema 2013.
See, the Oscars just tell you to fuck off, and then they'll go have an after party. We sit here and go like, read and drink and love.
2000. That's the end of the 2013 podcast. We've got a Facebook page. Like us on Facebook. Oh god, those words just sound dirty, but do it.
Do it.
Subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. Yeah, that's the
Reviews?
One I like.
Reviews?
Review us, but
email
we understand.
I find it funny. I really enjoy, like, if anyone tells us we're a pair of dickheads or tells us we're great. I find it fun.
Yes, so please do. And, we will be back sort of in roughly a month to start our three-part series on Michael Haneke.
Yeah.
We've
been talking about Haneke. I think we've been dropping references to Haneke in every podcast for about the last 2 years.
It's sort of like, you know, Hitchcock had his cameo. We have the Haneke.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks a lot. We'll be back soon and have a good one.